Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Billie Holiday, I sing your blues. Bet your life against me and I swear to God you'll lose it. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis. Motherfuck the cops, we still singing for St. Louis.
When it comes to naming prominent black inventors, most of us would probably come up with George Washington Carver. His contributions are numerous, but there are many, many names on the list of African-American inventors. Their names may not be widely known, but they are responsible for an impressive variety of inventions that touch our daily lives, from the ironing board to sophisticated computer technology and a whole lot in between. Some years ago, a Museum of Black Inventors was established here in St. Louis. It's now a traveling museum, and its founder, Loretta Ford, joins us in studio. Loretta, thanks for being with us. Great to have you.
Thank you for having me.
When and why did all of this get started in St. Louis?
No, it's really interesting. I attended a book fair at St. Louis University in 1995, and I picked up a book, Black Inventors of America, by Burt McKinley, Jr., and I start to thumb through the book, and I saw all of these amazing inventors that I had never learned about in elementary school. And just from there, I was determined to share it with as many people as I could.
And these, and now the show is on the road, as they say, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But what exactly did you have in these buildings? What was on display?
Well, we had, first we have photographs, drawings, documentations that make up our exhibit. But we also have hands-on replicas of inventions. And we had the biggest invention that we have that we actually don't travel with is a wagon. And that wagon, remember the old stagecoach wagons in the Western movies?
Only from what I've seen in the movies, Loretta, thank you.
It's sort of a replica of that. And that's one of the bigger. Then an antique icebox. We don't travel with that because it's extremely heavy. So those are some of the bigger items. But we also have all of our original items that are smaller that we do travel, like the baby carriage and some of the others that we do take on the road with us.
You know, I'm sure I know the answer to this question, but why do you think it is that so few of us know so anything about these people who have made extraordinary contributions?
You know, that is one of the reasons that I decided to start the Museum of Black Inventors, because I attended predominantly African-American schools. And as part of my history lessons, I only learned about George Washington Carver as
we
a black inventor. Right.
Yeah.
And his many contributions for the peanut and things. And I was just amazed that I've gone through school and just didn't have this history. This history was just not a part of our history books and not taught.
Well, we can talk about some of the specific inventors and inventions in just a moment.
Sure.
But one of the things that struck me in going over the list were the number of inventions that were created during the time of slavery.
Yeah.
I mean, that must have been extraordinarily difficult to have an idea and then be able to present it and have people accept it.
Well, you know, that's always fascinating to me, because at some point during slavery, in 1861, slaves were able to have their inventions recognized and able to get patents. Unfortunately, they could not make decisions about profits. they could not receive or anything. But it was actually decided during a controversial case where the actual slave master petitioned to the courts that if he owned the slave and that was his property, then the slave should not have a right to have a patent. And he actually won that case, and it stayed on the books there for maybe 4 or 5 years. And then it was overturned by the courts that slaves were free after 1865, and they were able to own their own patents.
But prior to that, they were not profiting at all from whatever they came up with.
The slave masters would get the profits, sure, and so forth.
Can you name a couple of these inventions that fall into this category?
There was a guy by the name of Ned, and Ned and his invention was related to the cotton gin, where he was able to make an apparatus that enabled the cotton gin to operate more efficient. And, of course, cotton is a big moneymaker during slavery, and that was one of the ones that was really, really difficult for him to achieve. He actually did go to court and against his master and lost.
Yeah, that was probably not a very easy thing to do.
Oh, absolutely not.
In that day. Another that I have on the list here we can talk about for a moment, this was post-slavery. This was in 1887, and that's Sarah Boone and the ironing board. Now, you wouldn't think that this would, you know, would be a great revelation, the ironing board, but I guess it was.
Well, Sarah Boone didn't invent the ironing board. She invented the sleeve, the ability for the ironing board to adjust and add an apparatus that allowed you to iron sleeves. And as you know, men's shirts and things like that were the bigger things that were ironed and in the early 1800s, but Sarah Boone actually created that. And it looks like a miniature ironing board when you see it in the museum, but it's actually supposed to be used for ironing the sleeves only. And she was one of the female inventors that created that
product. And there were a number of women. We certainly have to give them their due, as I go over the list, a number of them.
Yeah, Madam C.J. Walker is well-known and resided here in St. Louis for a number of years and was the actually first African-American millionaire that was an inventor. And she invented quite a few of the women's facial creams products, hair care products, and so forth. And it was still a billion-dollar industry, and she was one of the founders of that.
Hair care seems to have gotten a lot of attention, and I suspect it still does.
It does. Yeah. It does.
Yeah. Who are some of the other? I mean, there are a couple of them on the list, right?
Well, you've also got some local inventors here. Lonnie Johnson invented the Super Soaker water gun, which is one of the fun inventors. And you can go to any store now in the toys department, and you can find a Super Soaker water gun. But he was also an engineer and very brilliant man who lived in Illinois. And he was really creative in his inventions as well.
I know the one thing we did right,
hey, was the day we started to fight. Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on. Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on.
One of the most tragic moments in civil rights history unfolds through the eyes of a 13-year-old girl in Linda Williams Jackson's new young adult novel. Jackson weaves together two stories, a historical one about the murder of 14-year-old Emmett Till, and a fictional one about Rose Lee Carter, a sharecropper's granddaughter struggling to make sense of life under Jim Crow laws in the 1950s. Linda Williams Jackson joins me now to talk about her new book, Midnight Without a Moon. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
So why did you choose to center the story on the murder of Emmett Till? Why did you want to revisit that particular piece of history?
Initially, I wanted to write a story about my own family's life in the Mississippi Delta. And some years ago, maybe about 10 or 11 years ago, my mother mentioned Emmett Till, and she was in her 70s then. She had never mentioned Emmett Till before, and she actually didn't even say his name. I think there might have been something on the news about him. But for the first time, it just really struck me that, wow, this happened right here And my mom was just a young woman then. And I wanted to explore for myself what it might have felt like for them to have this happen so close to home.
So where do the two stories of Emmett Till and Rosalie Carter intersect in this book?
Papa, who is the grandfather of Rosalie Carter in the book, is a sharecropper in a fictional town called Stillwater, Mississippi, which is located in LaFleur County, which is also the location of Money, Mississippi, where Mose Wright, the great uncle of Emmett Till, was a tenant farmer. So to combine the two stories, I had Papa being an old friend of Mose Wright.
So how does Rose react to the murder of a boy who's about her same age in a nearby community? How does she process that?
She thinks about her own brother. So in the killing of Emmett Till, her emotions run high because this could have been my brother or this could have been my best friend, Hallelujah Jenkins. Especially seeing that Emmett Till is accused of whistling at a white woman, and her best friend, Hallelujah Jenkins, is kind of girl crazy. So, you know, Rose is thinking this could have been Hallelujah.
So you had mentioned that your mom had not ever talked about Emmett Till until way later in life. Did your family back then ever want to play a role in the civil rights movement?
I doubt it. And that was another reason why I wanted to write the book. I wanted to explore why they weren't concerned. I grew up knowing nothing about the NAACP, or I've heard of Martin Luther King, didn't know a whole lot about him. And frankly, I was kind of embarrassed as an adult when I realized how little I knew about the civil rights movement. That's why I have Rose curious to learn about the NAACP and the upcoming civil rights movement, because I didn't have that opportunity.
And what's interesting is you have her surrounded by characters who don't want to rock the boat. For example, Ma Pearl. She doesn't want Rose to learn about the NAACP because she didn't want her relatives to be demanding for progress and change. What was Ma Pearl supposed to represent in this story?
She's supposed to represent those people who fear the upcoming civil rights movement, those African Americans who were like my family, who were afraid of things changing. I remember just probably about 15 years ago visiting my aunt in Memphis. There was my mom, my aunt, and another aunt, and they were talking about how much the white people loved Pop, who was my grandfather. They, you know, didn't want him buried at the church cemetery. They didn't think that was good enough. And it got me to thinking, why did they love him? Did they love him because he was such a good man? Or did they love him because he was so complacent and because he stayed in his place and because he didn't make trouble? I don't know the answer to that, but it was something that I wanted to explore as well. So Ma Pearl would represent that group of people who were afraid to see change, because if change meant a fight, and they didn't want that fight.
Part of the backdrop in this book is what's known as the Great Migration North. Many African Americans wanted to flee to the North in search of better jobs, a better life. Rose herself is tempted. She wants a brighter future. Explain how come Rose is so incredibly conflicted about this decision, whether to go up north or remain in Mississippi.
She doesn't want to leave Papa. She doesn't want to leave her brother, Fred Lee, because he's already been abandoned enough. There's a sequel coming out in 2018, and you will find that there's some fear also in Rose of starting new. The sequel explains a little bit more why she chooses to stay.
Well, I can't wait for the sequel.
Thank you.
Linda Williams Jackson. Her book is called Midnight Without a Moon.
I don't want us to lose sight that things are getting better. each successive generation seems to be making progress in changing attitudes when it comes to race. Doesn't mean we're in a post-racial society. It doesn't mean that racism is eliminated. But, you know, when I talk to Malia and Sasha, and I listen to their friends and I see them interact, they're better than we are. They're better than we were on these issues. And that's true in every community that I've visited all across the country.
Damn you, Obama.
I spoke to Taylor Farrell's mother a day after he was arrested for vandalizing the Tuckahoe Little League Park. She wants you to know her son is not a racist.
He's my child, and I love him regardless. I'm not happy with his actions.
Sarah Maxey is opening up about her son, Taylor Farrell.
My child is one of those kids that would rather take the fall for everything and not snitch.
Her son is in a lot of trouble.
I'm upset with my son and what he did.
Sorry.
Vulgar, racist graffiti, smashed sinks, lights, and toilets were all found Thursday morning at the Tuckahoe Little League Park in Henrico County. Some words spray painted are so hateful we can't even show on TV. Friday, police arrested Maxey's 18-year-old son at a hotel on Broad Street and charged him with three counts of intentionally damaging property.
Can't understand for the life of me why he would have gone there or why he would have done that.
She says he wasn't alone and wasn't the mastermind behind the plan, but instead with a man who bought the paint at Walmart.
His quote-unquote friend supplied him with alcohol and took him out there.
She says he confessed to the crime at the park where he helped win a championship last year, but not to writing the most awful language on those walls.
He did admit, too, he broke the sink, he wrote oops, and he drew the pictures of genitalia, but he did not do the racist. None of that. His girlfriend is actually black.
Maxey revealed her son has had a troubled upbringing, but says her son isn't a mean person that deserves all the hate on social media.
One person said they should take a baseball bat to his hands and feet. It's pretty harsh.
She says detectives told her they continue to investigate the others who may be involved while her son remains in jail without bond.
I expect my son to suffer the consequences of his own actions.
Good news, the Little League Park is back open, but the bathrooms will stay closed until the necessary repairs are made. Stick with CBS 6 for the latest on this developing story.
You gold teeth, gold chain wearing, fried chicken and biscuit eating, monkey ate baboon, big thigh, fast running, high jumping, spear chucking, 360 degree basketball dunking, titsoon spade, moulinyak. Take your fucking pizza and go the fuck back to Africa.
For the past year or so, reports of racism at Saucon Valley High School started bubbling to the surface. Families say the verbal attacks got more and more aggressive.
He had been going through some stuff for some years. One of the students actually threw a Confederate flag at him. It was other slurs.
Al Rivers is the family friend of a 16-year-old black teenager at the school who's routinely harassed. The racism reached a boiling point in October when a 14-year-old white student posted a racist Snapchat video calling that black teen the N-word and saying he's on welfare.
Nigga!
Look at that. You know, he's on welfare. He probably can't even buy any chicken.
That Snapchat video sparked a schoolyard fight. At first, only the black student was charged with assault. But now, months later, the district attorney is also filing charges against the white student for ethnic intimidation and cyber harassment.
And harassment, you know, whether it's based on race or otherwise, is a crime.
The district attorney says this sends a message, especially to a group of white students at the school calling themselves the rednecks, responsible for harassing black kids for months.
It sends a message that this kind of conduct is not going to be tolerated, and hopefully it'll just break up the loose organization of boys who feel that they want to be a part of such an organization.
But some parents say the Saucon Valley District needs to do more to create an inclusive community.
So a zero-tolerance policy will help everybody up at the school and help all of them coexist in there.
And that was Randy Gyllenhaal reporting. The district tells us they have created an inclusion committee to work toward making all students feel valued and supported. The DA also told us both students are facing a probation-like program in juvenile court.
I was the first, one of the first. My first day was state trooper coming, putting me in the back seat of the car, and meeting the other black kids with six of us. And seeing all of those parents and also KKK members having signs and throwing cans at us, spitting at us. We lived in the threat of death every day, every day. So I was just lost in this vacuum between integration and segregation and racism. That was my childhood. I was angry for years. Angry. Very angry.
Cell phone video captures the moment a Wake County student was thrown to the ground by an officer.
Tonight, that officer is on administrative leave. WRL's Candace Witt spoke with the student and her mother tonight. Candace joins us now live outside the Rollsville Police Department. Candace?
The teen's mom says regardless of what happened before that 9-second clip that we have been seeing all day long, she says she still believes the officer's actions were excessive. The police chief tonight said he's asking the State Bureau of Investigation to look into the incident.
Jasmine Darwin says in the moment she hadn't fully grasped what had happened. Now, every time she sees the video,
I feel, every time I look at it, like, it's embarrassing.
This tweet went viral after a student at Rollsville High School posted a 9-second clip of Darwin being slammed to the ground by a Rollsville police officer, later identified as Ruben De Los Santos. Darwin says she was trying to break up a fight between her sister and another student when she was grabbed from behind.
I didn't even realize it happened. Like, I was in shock.
Rollsville Police Chief Bobby Langston confirms the officer was responding to a fight. At a town meeting, Chief Langston released a statement and asked for patience from the public.
No further information about this investigation will come out until it's complete. I have requested for the SBI to come in to give a third-party review.
No matter what comes from the investigation, Darwin's mother, Desiree Harris, says the officer's actions were excessive. She tells us she had no clue about the video or what happened to her daughter until after she took home her oldest daughter because of the fight.
When I'm looking at this video, I'm like, oh my God, this cannot be happening to my child.
She wants someone held accountable.
That's not how you handle a child. She's only 100 pounds. He could have killed her.
And Chief Langston wouldn't really go into detail about the possibility of video before that 9 seconds. Of course, a lot of people have questions about what happened leading up to what we've been seeing all day long. When asked about potential body camera footage, he says that he's not going to release any additional information at this time. But we do know that the officer, De Los Santos, has been on the force for about 5 years. He's now placed on administrative leave. And about an hour ago, we received a statement from Rollsville High School principal. She says 2 years ago, our school district enacted a unified agreement with all local enforcement agencies to provide training and a clear understanding of the duties and responsibilities of SROs. As part of the investigation, the district and law enforcement are reviewing those standards. So again, still a lot of questions from the community as this investigation continues. Deborah?
Candace went live in Rollsville. Thank you, Candace.
My name is Sabrina Johnson, and I'm here at the Race Relations Institute at Fisk University.
Fisk University opened in Nashville after the Civil War to educate freed slaves. Its students have gone on to become stars of the Harlem Renaissance and leaders in the civil rights movement. But the school still grapples with the dilemma that's been there since its beginning, how to become financially sustainable. Emily Siner from member station WPLN has the story.
Fisk is perhaps most widely known for its music. This is a recording of the Fisk Jubilee Singers in 1909, and its musical legacy is intertwined with money. Just 5 years after the school was founded in 1866, Congress stopped funding black colleges. Historian Revis Mitchell says money dried up.
When the school reached the point of less than a dollar left in the treasury, when there was no hope, a student chorus was put together in the fall of 1871.
That chorus of nine students set out on its first national tour.
They would present themselves, some the children of slaves, a few enslaved themselves, and the world was astonished by these young people from this place called Fisk.
The Jubilee Singers became legendary. They performed at the White House for President Grant. They traveled to England and sang for Queen Victoria. She instructed her court painter to create their portrait, which still hangs at Fisk today. And the tours worked. With the money the Singers raised, Fisk bought the land it sat on and built the campus's first permanent building. It's still a point of pride even today.
Lord, I'm out here on your word.
At Fisk events, speakers frequently invoke the original nine Jubilee Singers, thanking them for their dedication to the school. But as their legacy lives on, so does the financial burden they had tried to relieve. Fisk nearly went bankrupt in the 1980s. Then, a decade ago, it set off a long legal battle when it tried to sell famous paintings donated by Georgia O'Keeffe. The school was later put on temporary probation for its finances. That's not to say it's always been shaky. Mary Beth Gassman at the Penn Center for Minority-Serving Institutions actually wrote her dissertation on what she calls Fisk's golden years, the 1940s and 50s.
And that's really the last time that Fisk had like real financial success, and they were at the helm of HBCUs.
To get back to that point, Gassman says Fisk needs a few things. It needs stable leadership. It's been cycling through presidents lately. It also needs to buckle down on fundraising, getting potential donors excited about the school today, not just its history.
No one's going to give to Fisk merely because of the Jubilee Singers or Jubilee Hall. You know, they want to see what Fisk is doing now.
That's one of the biggest challenges for Jens Fredriksen. He's in charge of fundraising. He says he wants to move the school away from its reputation of being strapped for cash.
I think for a long time we were probably mired down in a few familiar narratives that sort of usurped all the press.
Instead, Fredriksen wants to highlight academics. For example, Fisk is nationally ranked for its master's program in physics. He's also trying to increase alumni and private company donations. The Jubilee Singers still have a role in all this, 150 years later. They're seen as ambassadors for the university as they travel around the country to perform. But this time, the fortunes of the school no longer rest on their voices. For NPR News, I'm Emily Siner in Nashville.
He from the ghetto. Niggas want to know what the ghetto is. Niggas don't know what the ghetto is. I know what the ghetto is. I live the ghetto. We live the ghetto every day. The mentality is the ghetto. Stay with my people. Make money with my people, man. Why y'all fighting me, man? Fight them, man. Be on my side, dog. Us together against them, we'll slay them. That's ghetto. Stay ghetto. Live ghetto. Be ghetto, man. For real.
Looks like recently the New York Post reported on a restaurant in the meatpacking district that's currently being sued for discriminating against black patrons that frequented the restaurant. And the name of that restaurant is Bagatelle. And it looks like it's a French-owned bistro-style restaurant that specializes in serving brunch. And it looks like there was a former employee that's a part of the suit that really gave up all the inside scoop on what they were doing in the restaurant. And it looks like whenever a black customer came in, that they would sit them in a section or a table called table 157 in the back of the restaurant, and the staffers called it the ghetto station. That's right, they called it the ghetto station. And they would force patrons to sit down and share two seats, and they even had photos to prove it. And then they would accidentally lose reservations for patrons that they did not want to serve at that restaurant. So say, for instance, you are a black customer. You made a reservation there. When you came to the restaurant, they simply just, for some reason, couldn't find it. Or it would get lost intentionally. And they had many code words and acronyms that they used, such as DNA, that they would put on the bills of customers that were black. And that meant do not accommodate. If they were considered an ugly customer, they were branded with BO. And so it looks like, you know, not only were they discriminating against black customers, but they were also discriminating against their employees. And the French employees were getting treated better. And there were some non-French employees that said they were being sexually harassed and experiencing obscene behavior. And the funny part, you know, about this article is that they said, you know, the everyday black person couldn't get in there. But apparently celebrities, the black celebrities could, you know, come in there. They mentioned Serena Williams, Jamie Foxx, Jay-Z, and Beyonce dining on its $280 seafood tower, or its king crab ceviche. So, but it said when four African Americans without, you know, celebrity names showed up last summer, they were led to a table with only three chairs. So four people got a table with three chairs, which means that two people were forced to share a seat. And, you know, someone that worked there, that's a part of the lawsuit, he told them, we do have enough chairs for them not to be forced to share seats. He said, we do have the chairs. This shouldn't be happening. Four people in three chairs, really? And he was allegedly told, we don't want them here. So it looks like if you had money, if you were a big name, they didn't mind, you know, you coming in there if you were a Beyonce or a Jay-Z. But if you were just an everyday, you know, non-celebrity individual, even though it looks like they're spending big bucks, $280 for a seafood tower, a lot of money for some food and a place where I have to share a seat with another person. And so, you know, we really do have to expose these kind of businesses, because why do you want to go in there and spend $280 with someone that's putting DNA, do not accommodate, that's losing reservations, that's making you share seats, that's trying to make you uncomfortable so you don't come back? You know, we have to stop, you know, wanting to, you know, go to a restaurant that's seating you in the ghetto station. You know, I want to make sure, you know, that we report on this and get that out there, because we don't want to keep giving money to people that don't care about us. They probably did all those things and did not mind sliding the credit card or taking the cash to pay for their food. So we really have to stop, you know, going in these restaurants and these establishments that do not want us to be there, that, you know, discriminate against customers. And, you know, we really have to begin to have our own restaurants and, you know, patronize our own businesses. You know, it's kind of funny, you know, we want to go into these restaurants, you know, for the status. You know, we think it's cool. It shows that we've arrived, to go into these type of restaurants and eat a $280 plate of food and, you know, give a certain look or appearance. And we really have to stop doing that. And we walk by our own, you know, businesses all the time, and we go to these types of establishments. And maybe, just maybe, if we would go into our own, you know, black owned businesses, or, you know, other small businesses that do support our communities, just maybe if we would actually put our money into those businesses, maybe they could, you know, reinvest back in their own business and, you know, make it, you know, even, you know, better and upgrade their businesses. But a lot of times these small businesses are closing down because we're not investing in them. You know, we should feel appalled, you know, to go and invest in some other you know, establishment that doesn't want us there and spend $280 for a plate and won't go into another business that maybe is only charging you $25 for a plate and they can barely keep it together or whatever. And this business, you know, don't even want you to be in there. And so that's something that we have to really think about. Why do we feel like it's better to go in a restaurant like this as opposed to going and supporting one of our own restaurants in our own neighborhoods, and not only investing in them, but we'd be investing in our communities. We'd be creating jobs in our communities. We'd be helping support a family. We might even be able to help that particular business to expand.
So much for integration. Don't know what I was thinking. I'm moving back to Southside. So much for integration. Don't know what I was thinking. I'm moving back to Southside.
New at 6, a Winter Haven woman gets a shocking surprise when she walks to her car. Someone wrote the N-word and drew a naked woman on the hood of her car, and they used mustard to do it. Mustard. The vandalism has her worried that she might be targeted. Whoever did it apparently hit a number of neighbors as well. Fox 13's Ken Suarez takes a look at this very unusual crime spree.
And I never use live at all.
Cecilia Sanders is usually pretty quiet, but the other day she couldn't hold back, so she went on Facebook Live.
I'm a black woman. This is serious.
Someone had written the N-word and drew a naked woman on the hood of her car, and the culprit used, get this, mustard to do it.
I got scared for the whole situation that my life was in danger, that somebody was watching me and everything.
And out to get her.
So you thought you were targeted?
Yes.
Because you're black?
Yeah, I think so. It had the N-word on my hood, on the car, and I felt like that's what it was.
Other people close to Avenue T Southeast were hit, too. A curse word written in mustard on this nearby mailbox. Mustard and jelly smeared on two cars at another home. The Polk Sheriff's Office is trying to get to the bottom of it.
It's probably juveniles running around doing some sort of prank. School's been out for 2 weeks. Kids get into mischief sometimes.
Neighbors like Tyrone James are taking the racial slur much more seriously.
It's some type of prejudice or bigotry or something went on other than prank. We went past that stage.
You might say, wow, that's vandalism. Actually, it's not. To be vandalism, there has to be damage. You can wash off mustard with just a little bit of water. Still, detectives say if they catch whoever is behind this, they'll be held accountable.
It should be something that they always could do about something like that. Always. They shouldn't let that slide.
Whatever it takes, Sanders wants this distasteful condiment caper to be shelved for good. In Polk County, Ken Suarez, Fox 13 News.
Well, the sheriff's office is taking the incident seriously. They are increasing patrols in the area.
I had a dog growing up. Show you a picture of him. Black, white feet, white throat, little white tip on his tail. I love that dog. That dog knew when I was going to service. He knew when I got in trouble. He knew when I was phoning home. He'd come up, lay on the porch, and look at the phone. And it'd ring if it was from me. He'd bark like wild, make sure somebody answered the phone. You know what his name was? Nigger.
Nigger!
And that was your dog.
That's right. I love that dog. That wasn't no bad name. That's because he was black, shiny, pretty, muscular. Come on, nigger.
So tonight, a community is rallying around a man after he got a rude awakening. Racial slurs spray painted on his house and his SUV set on fire.
Police are looking for the person responsible for this disturbing crime.
And now there's an arson investigation underway in Highlands. Josh Marshall is live on San Jacinto Street with a look at how the community is responding. Josh?
It may have only taken just one person to paint those racial slurs and light the car on fire, but it's taken dozens of near strangers to correct the problem, erasing those messages of hate and making this homeowner feel at home again. Scorched metal and melted plastic.
My car was destroyed.
Red spray paint demanding the African-American homeowner to leave.
And thanks to the fire department, they helped get the racial slurs off the house.
He didn't want us to use his name or show his face, only wanting to explain how he's feeling.
I felt it in my gut. I felt bad, you know, that people would actually, in this day and time, still do stuff like this.
Highland's neighbors, feeling the same way, stopped by extending friendship.
This is not who we are, and this is not what we want shown in our community at all.
Who and why are the only questions left to answer.
And I've been trying to figure that out myself. Was I targeted? You just don't want me here? Or you trying to send a message or what? I don't know.
The homeowner is a felon. His last offenses are gun and drug charges from 2014 and 15.
There are some things that happened, you know, in the past, and the only thing people can do is try to change where they were in their past and try to do good, and that's what I've been trying to do.
The homeowner says his past convictions don't have anything to do with the fire or messages painted on his property. To get closer to those answers of who and why, investigators are taking a closer look at surveillance video from nearby businesses. So far, no answers. Live in Highlands, Josh Marshall, KHOU 11 News.
She's my friends, but I'm in France. I'm just saying.
To the Central African Republic, now and six French soldiers who are accused of sexual assaults against minors will not now face criminal charges in France, according to judicial sources. The accused were heard by an investigating judge who decided that there wasn't enough evidence to warrant a prosecution or any further investigation. The soldiers had served in the Central African Republic as part of a peace mission dispatched to the country after chaos broke out there following a coup in 2013. The alleged sexual assaults are said to have happened between December 2013 and June 2014 at a camp for displaced people near the airport in the capital, Bangui. So how did the judge justify the decision? The BBC's Hugh Schofield is in Paris.
We haven't seen the detail of his decision. It has been reported in the French news agency, but I think we can read between the lines that it's just been impossible for them to substantiate in their interviews out in Bangui the substance of the allegations. Just to recap, this was an investigation launched 2.5 years ago. It was then remained secret, but was made public when The Guardian in Britain newspaper reported it. After that, you know, the investigation was a fact of public knowledge, and it was confirmed that on two occasions the investigating magistrates went out to Bangui in last year and the year before on two occasions to speak to the children, because it is children, or certainly people in their young teens who are at the centre of this, speak to them to try to firm up the allegations against the soldiers. In the end, it seems they were unable to do that, and as a result, it's been reported now, it's been leaked really, that the investigation has terminated, and there is technically a possibility that charges will be referred against these men, because there's still a period now in which the civil parties can file, you know, demands for extra investigations. It seems pretty unlikely that that's going to happen now.
Hugh Schofield in Paris. Well, for reaction, I spoke to the organisation that initially revealed the allegations by leaking documents to the Guardian newspaper in the United Kingdom. Paula Donovan is the co-director of AIDS Free World and their Code Blue campaign, which seeks to end impunity for peacekeeper sexual abuse.
I think it's reprehensible. It's ridiculous that the French government wasn't able to find the perpetrators of these heinous crimes against children.
But an investigating judge has basically decided that there's no evidence to warrant a prosecution or further investigation.
Well, I think, Paul, what has to be considered is comparative attention that might have been given to this case if the children were French children in Paris rather than African children in Bangui. I mean, I read the reports that were produced by the UN staff members who interrogated the children, and I find it absolutely impossible to believe that given the level of detail and the identifying features that the children disclosed to these UN staff members, that the French could not possibly have found either the perpetrators immediately or eyewitnesses to these horrible events.
So at least you think that given the evidence, this would have warranted a prosecution at least?
Absolutely. Absolutely. They were identifying features that can't be changed. Tattoos, body piercings, height, racial composition, that sort of thing. That and, of course, there are not that many soldiers who were on duty in the capital of the Central African Republic on the dates that these children were violated.
Now, the judge has made this ruling. Is this the end of the road as far as you're concerned?
I certainly don't think it should be. I think that this case should be referred to the International Criminal Court.
Now, your organization deals with these sorts of allegations regularly. How often do you see charges brought, let alone convictions?
Almost never. In fact, in the time since the Code Blue campaign was launched in May of 2015, I don't know of more than maybe three cases in the Democratic Republic of the Congo where soldiers were indicted and brought to trial. They were brought to trial in the Democratic Republic of the Congo rather than in the country where the alleged crimes were committed. But all in all, hundreds and hundreds of reports of sexual exploitation and abuse by UN and French peacekeeping personnel. Of all those hundreds, we have not seen anything that could even approach justice. The numbers of indictments are extraordinarily rare.
And in a word, despite this, you still continue?
What we're advocating for now is that a special court system be set up that's independent of the United Nations Secretariat, because the Secretariat, as I've said, has been interfering rather than assisting in criminal matters over which it has absolutely no authority to intervene. So what we'd like to see is a special court mechanism set up that can deal with this issue quickly and on site with international investigators who are unbiased, who are not connected with the countries involved. We'll start with the civilian peacekeeping personnel. And if that's successful, then the member states, the troop contributing countries, may also wish to subscribe to this kind of court and simply deal with these cases as soon as they arise, while the evidence is fresh and while the victims can be treated in a way that might help them to recover and rehabilitate.
Paula Donovan of the Code Blue campaign.
This the city of Chicago. Chicago.
The number of casualties in Chicago since last New Year's Day has surged to a level more in line with a war zone than one of America's great cities. More than 700 people were murdered, over 4,000 shot. That's more than Los Angeles and New York combined. Gangs, guns, and drugs have caused chaos in Chicago for years. But something new caught our attention. There has been a drop in the kind of police work that law enforcement says is critical to preventing crime. Usually stops and arrests go up when violence is rising. So we went to Chicago to look for an explanation. What we found was a police department on its heels as the city suffered its worst bloodshed in 18 years. In the 6 days we were in Chicago, 55 people were shot, 16 were killed. We were struck by just how routine it all felt. The dead and wounded were removed with grim efficiency, right down to the hazmat crews that cleaned away the blood. Murder seemed almost normal.
And now we are the poster boy of violence in America.
Stop the violence!
Stop the violence!
Michael Flager is pastor of St. Sabina Church on Chicago's South Side.
No more shooting!
His congregation started summer weekends by praying for a low body count.
I had three different families call in one day asking to do the funeral of their child who was killed in the last week. I've never had that in 41 years here. Three families in one day.
59 gangs are at war over territory and drugs on Chicago's west and south sides. But the makeshift memorials we saw also mark places where people were killed in gang initiations or over petty insults.
They pop a stove back over for the kids.
This gang member was taunting a rival on his phone live on the internet when he was shot. Watch and you'll see the gunman.
What's it like around here on a typical Saturday night these days?
I've never seen there to be a combination of anger, distrust, and a feeling like communities have been abandoned. Shame on us that our children are afraid to go out of their house of being shot and killed. When is the tipping point that we all say, enough?
No, the shooter popped out of the car and shot.
But we were astonished by data we obtained from inside the police department. It revealed that as killings rose, police activity fell. In August of 2015, cops stopped and questioned 49,257 people. A year later, those stops dropped to 8,859, down 80%. At the same time, arrests were off by a third, from just over 10,000 to 6,900.
You talk to cops every day.
We do.
What's the morale?
Lowest it's ever been.
Brian Warner is a former Chicago cop. He was shot in 2011. Now, Warner counsels officers suffering from extreme stress. He explained what a dozen beat cops told us off camera. They had stepped back.
You have a 911 call, you go to your 911 call. But if you want an aggressive patrol, when you're out looking for people breaking the law, that's not happening as much as it was.
But you say they're not being as proactive.
No, they're not. And how could you ask them to be, and why would you expect them to be?
Because it's their job. They signed on to do that.
It's my job to go to work and listen to your 911 calls and respond to my 911. That's the basic ability of my job. So if you want me to do the basics, that's what I'm doing now.
The police activity is horrific, honestly, and there's not an excuse that could be made in my book.
We showed the stop and arrest data that we got to Gary McCarthy. He was superintendent of the Chicago Police Department until just a year ago.
When you have activity falling off the way it is and crime skyrocketing, that's a huge problem.
Some people looking at the Chicago Police Department have said it's in crisis.
Crisis is a good word. When people are dying, yes, there's crisis. No two ways about it.
This crisis inside the police department began in 2014 with the shooting of Laquan McDonald. He was 17 years old. Police reported McDonald was breaking into vehicles and ignored their commands when they said he lunged at one of them with a knife. But dashboard video appears to show McDonald was moving away when he was shot 16 times by a white officer.
When did you first see the video?
I saw the video. I believe it was the day after.
What would you think?
I said that there's a problem, and the officer is going to be accountable for explaining his actions.
Gary McCarthy immediately gave the case to the independent city agency that reviews shootings. But City Hall refused to make the video public, even after it paid McDonald's family a $5 million settlement. When a judge finally ordered the video released a year later, it sparked outrage. Protesters accused the city of a cover-up to protect Mayor Rahm Emanuel's re-election. The mayor denied it, but promised sweeping changes. His first move was to fire Gary McCarthy.
The public trust in the leadership of the department has been shaken.
Do you think you were made a scapegoat?
I don't think it helped the situation. And I think it's a contributory factor to where we are today in Chicago. And if you want to call it scapegoat, that's fine.
The cop who killed Laquan McDonald is awaiting trial for murder, and the U.S. Justice Department is investigating the Chicago PD. We wanted to talk to Mayor Emanuel, but he declined. Within 6 weeks of the shooting scandal, investigative stops fell by nearly 35,000. That's when the violence began to surge.
How can a police officer who has taken a vow to protect and serve defend stepping back from taking proactive action? How can you
Officers are under attack. That's how they feel, right? That's how they feel in this environment. And they're not going to put themselves and their families in jeopardy.
Frustration among cops deepened with a new order to be more selective about who they stopped and write a 2-page detailed report for everyone. It was the result of a threat by the American Civil Liberties Union to sue the department for racial profiling.
It doesn't seem that filling out a 2-page report is that onerous.
Oh, sure it is. It could take you up to 45 minutes. And one of the things in policing that we've been trying to do is knock back the amount of time that officers spend doing paperwork and get them out doing more proactive things to prevent crime.
There are reasons for the scrutiny. Since 2004, the city has paid out more than $500 million in settlements for police misconduct. A task force appointed by the mayor found evidence of racial bias and reported that nearly 90% of police shootings involved minorities.
The Chicago Police Department is not racist, but I do know and do believe that there are racist police officers in the Chicago Police Department.
Richard Wooten broke ranks and talked to the mayor's task force about what he saw during his 23 years as a Chicago cop.
They put me in a car with this guy, and my first couple of stops, I saw this guy stop a black guy, you know, several black guys on the street, and they literally almost got strip searched right in the middle of the street. And I'm looking like, wow, is this the way it's supposed to be done?
You were called a traitor for speaking out.
Oh, yes. At my retirement party, when I got up to speak, a group of white boys in the back, they booed me, called me traitor, snitch.
Was the booing the extent of it?
No. I went into the restroom, and I was confronted by a couple of the guys in the restroom about, you know, my position and how could I do that after 20-some years of service. But then as I'm looking into the urinal, I see my picture that they've torn out the program in each urinal.
They put your picture?
My picture inside the urinals. But I wasn't angry, Bill.
You weren't angry?
I was not angry because that just told me how dysfunctional we have of officers we have on the police department.
The turmoil was not lost on gang members who record their attempts to lure officers into a confrontation.
Say hi.
This video was posted online by someone claiming to be connected to the Simon City Royal Street Gang.
No questions, gentlemen, no questions.
The impact was evident during this October arrest. Officer Veronica Murillo says it was the fear of becoming the next viral video that kept her from pulling her gun as she struggled with this suspect. He knocked her down and bashed her head into the pavement.
Let it go!
Let it go!
She suffered neurological damage that has endangered her career.
The noncompliance with the law is becoming legitimized, and the police are on their heels. They were on their heels for a number of reasons.
How dangerous is that?
We see the results, don't we? We're reaching a state of lawlessness, right? That's what's happening.
Dozens of innocent people have paid the price.
I pray every night and every day that no hurt, harm, or danger will come to my children.
Flora White's prayers went unanswered. She showed us the parking lot where her 26-year-old son, Jonathan, was murdered in July. He played basketball in college and in Europe.
He wasn't out here selling drugs. He wasn't out here gangbanging. He wasn't doing any of that.
And yet he ended up dead.
Exactly.
Jonathan was on his way to practice when he stopped to talk to friends. Investigators say he was shot by a gang member who was angry they were on his turf.
By our count, there have been about a dozen shootings just this August, just in the area surrounding the spot where Jonathan was killed.
Mm-hmm.
Yet at the same time, stops by police in the neighborhood have dropped by almost 80%. What do you think of that?
What do I think of that? I think it's a joke of accountability in politics.
We went looking for accountability from Chicago's new police superintendent, Eddie Johnson.
And this is where the incident just happened. It's right here.
Yep.
He worked his way up over a 28-year career.
If I found someone that intentionally was not doing his job, then I would discipline him. This is a tough job. It's a dangerous job, but it's also a noble job.
Johnson insisted the main reasons for the drop in police activity were stricter standards for stops and the forms triggered by the ACLU. But he admitted his cops have become more careful.
They are cautious about doing their jobs.
You're calling it caution. They're telling us that it's backing down.
You know, I still go out in the field and I talk to officers too, and they take offense to people referring to them as backing down or not doing their job.
Well, the one number that I think is not in dispute is the homicide rate has gone, not just the rate, the number of homicides have skyrocketed. So the number of stops and arrests are going down dramatically, and the number of people being shot and killed are going up dramatically. There's got to be a correlation.
Well, you know, there may be some, you know, but again, I'd have to go back to it's not what the police officers are not doing. It's more about what these, what the criminal offenders are doing.
But don't the police play a role?
Yeah, we play a role in terms of mitigating it and, you know, arresting.
But it's not being mitigated.
No, I wouldn't say that. What we can't measure is the crime that we stop.
Johnson is hiring and promoting 1,000 cops in an attempt to get a handle on the violence. But it'll take a year under his plan to get reinforcements to where Flora White lost her son, Jonathan.
What good is it going to do?
You don't think more police on the street will make a difference?
I'm going to hire more people to do a job that's not being done? What sense do that make?
Chicago. Racism is wrong in any shape, form. There are a lot of black people who are racist, too.
This sounds dangerously like reverse discrimination to me.
White people yelling reverse racism.
Alleged kidnapping and torture stream live on Facebook. A white teenager with special needs tied up and beaten as a group of young African-Americans shouting anti-white slurs and calling out Donald Trump. Tough stuff to watch. Good morning, everybody. That is where we start as we work through the facts of this story as we get them. I'm Bill Hemmer, and welcome here to America's Newsroom.
Hey, Bill. Good morning, everybody. I'm Martha McCallum. So this shocking story breaking in Chicago, and we want to warn you, this video is very disturbing to watch. It shows an 18-year-old victim who was tied and gagged. The suspects put a knife to his throat at different points in this video. They make him drink from the toilet. They shout expletives against white people and against the president-elect. This torture goes on for more than 30 minutes. Listen.
Donald Trump, white people, boy.
Bill. Goof.
Yeah.
My sister's up there with
John. Yeah,
my sister said this is not fun, y'all.
From Chicago, police have arrested 4 so far. Matt Finn is live there in the Windy City to begin our coverage. Let's talk about charges, Matt. When will they be filed?
Bill, police tell us those 4 attackers are in custody right now, and the charges are expected to be filed later today. Police tell us they think this mentally challenged teen is from the suburbs and was driven into the city in a stolen van. Police say he was held captive for up to 48 hours and then released. He was found wandering in the cold. Here's how the Chicago police superintendent responded to all this.
It's sickening. You know, it makes you wonder what would make individuals treat somebody like that.
Bill, this morning, a big question is whether this rises to the level of a hate crime. If it does, these attackers face up to 30 years in prison.
Certainly, Bill. It's catching fire online and across the country. What are people saying, Matt?
Yeah, major responses online. First, people seem to be outraged that there are people online making jokes about this video, perhaps even cheering on the attackers. And there is also outrage over a Chicago detective who said this might amount to nothing more than just a childhood prank. Take a listen to that.
Kids make stupid decisions. I shouldn't call them kids. They're legally adults, but they're young adults, and they make stupid decisions.
That police official obviously taking a lot of heat. Many people also tying this to the Black Lives Matter movement, giving its own hashtag BLM kidnapping. One Twitter user writing, BLM is being linked with BLM kidnapping because so many people have experienced violence, vandalism, and racist hatred at the hands of BLM. In response to these types of tweets, the Black Lives Matter Chicago Twitter account wrote back saying, some people are disgusting. You're making jokes. What happened to the teenager is terrible and tragic. However, it has nothing to do with the BLM. Bill, we are following this story. We will be attending the press conference later today where we might learn what these 4 attackers will be charged with.
More to
Bill.
Come on that then. Thanks. Matt Finn leading our coverage there in Chicago.
We do not know whether the killer of Reverend Pinckney and 8 others knew all of this history. but he surely sensed the meaning of his violent act. It was an act that drew on a long history of bombs and arson and shots fired at churches. Not random, but as a means of control, a way to terrorize and oppress. An act that he imagined would incite fear and recrimination, violence and suspicion. An act that he presumed would deepen divisions that trace back to our nation's original sin. Oh, but God works in mysterious ways.
In the last hour, Dylann Roof's journals from jail were read during the sentencing phase of his federal death penalty trial. The convicted killer murdered 9 people inside Mother Emanuel AME Church in 2015. Raphael James live at the federal courthouse in downtown Charleston. Raphael, there were some concerns today about how this part of the trial is going.
Yes, that's right, Debbie. Perhaps most of the explosive action came from the defense side of the courtroom today. Let's see if I can set a picture for you. Imagine yourself in an operating room. You've got one of the world-class surgeons right there, and you decide to perform your own surgery. Well, that is similar to the case we have here. David Bruck, who is the standby counsel for Dylann Roof, is well respected in capital defense cases in this country, and he is the standby counsel. And Dylann Roof, it seems, is not following his lead. He's not objecting when Bruck says he should object. He's not filing motions when Bruck says he should file motions. In fact, Bruck says he suggested Roof file a mistrial motion, and we later learned Dylann Roof chose not to do so. He is acting as his own attorney. Meanwhile, Bruck says today in court that Roof is unqualified, and he petitioned the judge again to reinstate him as the lead counsel on this case so that the integrity of the case would not suffer any more than it already has, due process. The judge denied that and said Dylann Roof knew what he was getting into when he chose to be his own attorney in this case, and he has the constitutional right to do so. So he will continue to represent himself. Now, Karina Bolster has more for you on some of the testimony that went forth in court today.
Raphael, we heard a lot of emotional testimony from family members, but perhaps the most jaw-dropping testimony wasn't from a family member at all. It was from a criminal intelligence officer with the Charleston County Sheriff's Office. Lauren Knapp says Dylann Roof was placed on suicide protocol in August of 2015 when she was notified about Roof's first outbound letter that Roof planned to send. Now, in that letter were writings of a historical book that urged young people to commit suicide. Now, when a search was done of Roof's jail cell, officers found several drawings and documents. Now, one of those documents, which was several pages long, in it, Roof wrote, quote, "I do not regret what I did. I'm not sorry. I have not shed a tear for the innocent people I have killed," end quote. Now, we are expected to hear from an FBI agent tomorrow regarding this, what's being termed a jailhouse manifesto. We're also expected to hear from family members of Cynthia Hurd, Ethel Lance, and Susie Jackson. Now, the prosecution believes it could wrap up its case by Monday afternoon. Raphael?
All right, Karina, thank you very much. And we've heard from the defense, from Bruck, that there are too many witnesses on the list to be called to testify, and that up until this point, the witnesses of the families, the victims, have taken too long. In fact, Bruck stood up once to say this is his sentencing, Dylan's roof, not a memorial service, stating that it read more like a tribute to the family members than a sentencing phase for Dylan Roof. Attorneys who were in the audience also saw this and said this is not the way capital cases normally go. And in court, Judge Gergel as well said that this was his first capital defense sentencing as well, or capital punishment sentencing, as well as the prosecutor's term. I talked with an attorney from North Carolina who said that these things normally don't work quite this way.
Well, the prosecutor seems to be working and operating by a script that only he knows about. And when the evidence that comes in is as prejudicial as this, it's sort of extraordinary that that evidence is not reviewed beforehand by counsel or by the court.
And he says, Attorney Hill says, that is complicated or compounded when Dylan Roof won't stand up and object or fight for himself. Our Carter Coyle was also in court today. And Carter, you got to hear some of that testimony and see the emotion that the family puts themselves through day in and day out.
It's hard for people who don't know these victims. So I cannot imagine what it feels like for the family members, the children of the victims who are in there hearing these details. Again today, similar to yesterday, there was a lot of crying as the testimony kind of progressed through each victim. Also some lighter moments, again, as family members went over kind of quirks, personality traits, those sort of things, kind of inside knowledge that the family was laughing quietly at, clearly things that they knew about. It was especially hard hearing from some of the younger witnesses today. The 16-year-old daughter of Sharonda Singleton, two of DePayne Middleton Doctor's daughters, who are both young in their 20s, spoke. That was especially heartbreaking, and hearing how they described their mom as their best friend. There was a break from that emotion toward the end of the day as the jury heard those jailhouse journal writings Karina mentioned earlier. People in the courtroom were kind of shaking their heads in disbelief as they heard of that rant on paper. Again today, Raphael, lots of hugs, people kind of huddling together between testimony, crying some, praying some, just comforting each other. Clearly a family a comfort for them to all be together in this hard time.
And of course, this is a death penalty trial. He is looking at either life in prison with no chance of parole or being given a death sentence. Now, I polled some of the family members today, and they're not so crystal clear as to what all of them want. There are some who are decidedly, yes, I want him to get the death penalty. I want him to pay for what he's done. But I talked to several more, and they say, no, we don't believe in the death penalty. Back to you in the studio.
Neil, thank you. And earlier this afternoon, Roof's state trial was delayed indefinitely. Now, that trial was set to start in a little over a week on January 17th, but a judge's order says more time is needed to prepare since this federal trial is still ongoing. Roof faces 13 state charges, including 9 murder and 3 attempted murder charges.
The trial of Dylan Roof has come to a close. Today, journals the church shooter wrote in jail were read aloud in the courtroom. Of course, he killed 9 people inside Mother Emanuel back in 2015. Our Raphael James is outside of the federal courthouse right now. Now, Raphael, the defense claims that the evidence being presented is unfair.
That's right, Lisa. They set forth a motion today to the court saying that, among other things, the evidence was unfair. They wanted the judge to take more breaks. They protested because the prosecution hugged one of the witnesses after she broke down on the witness stand. But you're right. They claim that the victim impact statements or testimony was prejudicial, meaning it was unfair and that there was too much of it. They called it excessive. For an example of what kind of testimony we're talking about, Sharonda Singleton's son created a poem or a letter to his mother, and some of that was played in court. I'll play a little bit of it for you here.
Dear Mama, I hope heaven's treating you well. I'm stuck here living on earth, and sometimes I feel like hell without a hatred.
And I'm talking about how the judge addressed all of this.
There were instances like that, poems, prayers. There was an audio tape of Sharonda Singleton saying a prayer at a friend's father's funeral that happened just a week before she was killed herself. Now, Judge Gergel did address the defense's
claim or the defense's claims about these things being inappropriate and unfair. Colby, Carter, what did he have to say? I'm sorry.
Judge Gergel pretty much immediately after lunch said, okay, let's address this motion. First of all, he said it's completely inaccurate, fundamentally inaccurate. He said that it was standby counsel's effort to, quote, mischaracterize and exaggerate what's happening in the courtroom. Now, as far as the emotion in the courtroom that Roof was complaining about in that motion, he said the judge said to suggest that this could be some sort of sanitized proceeding is pretty much impossible. Judge Gergel said each of these nine victims was a child of God. Each of them had a story to tell, and that the jury is entitled to a quick glimpse into their lives. The judge also said he would pretty much be stunned if the jurors weren't crying at some point and that people weren't getting emotional, and that this was all completely proper at this point. Yesterday, prosecutors said Roof was the one who chose to murder so many people, and that it was not the government's fault that so many family and friends wanted to talk about the victims. Today, we also heard about papers found in Dylan Roof's Charleston County jail cell. Some were lists of his favorite movies. Others were things like cartoons and drawings of white supremacist symbols. Raphael, we also heard dozens of pages from his jailhouse, what the prosecutors are calling his jailhouse manifesto. It's a journal he was keeping in jail. He says in that journal he does not regret the shootings and that he has not at any point shed so much as a tear for the, quote, innocent people I killed. Very hard to hear that in court today.
And how did the family react to that?
Everybody was shaking their heads. There were definitely some kind of gasps. I mean, just to hear it spelled out so coldly, it was very difficult.
And I imagine the jurors had some reactions to that as well. And as far as that impact testimony goes, that victim impact testimony, they say that is excessive. They don't want to have it that way, where the victims get up and spend what the defense would describe as inordinate amounts of time talking about it. And Mr. Bruck even stood up in court today and said, this is his sentencing, not a memorial service. Lisa, back to you.
Hepatitis gets a knockout punch. Just a few hours ago, I placed a call to my civil lawyer, Brett Grote, of the Pittsburgh-based Abolitionist Law Center. I could hear the excitement in his voice. Then he told me that we had won the Abu Jamal versus Wetzel case, and the judge, Judge Robert Mariani, granted our motion for a preliminary injunction, ordering healthcare staff to cease their unconstitutional protocol and begin treatment of my hepatitis infection with direct-acting antiviral medications. It was good to hear and good to win. I thought of the good, hard work by Brett and attorney Bob Boyle. I thought of the many people who filled the courtroom because of the organizing prowess of Sister Pam Africa, Dr. Suzanne Ross, Dr. Johanna Fernandez, and others who made it happen. I thought of Dr. Joseph Harris, M.D., who, as an expert witness, hushed the courtroom by his medical explanations, which made scientific arguments so clear that anyone could understand it. And I thought of thousands of prisoners in Pennsylvania suffering from the ravages of hepatitis C and now who have hope. I thought of the prisoners who suffered from hepatitis C and died from this infection as their liver failed to function. They did not live long enough to see this day. Well, I think spread the word because, you know, this is not what the Commonwealth wants people to know about, that they really engaged in unconstitutional medical practices designed not to cure and not even to treat, but to work on symptoms instead of disease. Here you have something that is very rare in the world of medicine. You know, doctors rarely speak of cures. They speak of treatments. Here we have a cure. And the government of Pennsylvania refused to give it to thousands of people for years until they got to the brink of death. My sister Pam told me something the other day about a Puerto Rican brother down Gratis, Florida. They had him wait so long that when they approved him for treatment, he took one pill for one day, and by the next day, he was dead. So that's, you know, that to say that's unconstitutional, again, is an understatement. It's not medicine, you know, it's business, and it's profit, and it's not caring for the health of the people that you swore.
This is a call from
Pennsylvania State Correctional Institution, Mahanoy.
Well, yeah, thanks for calling in, and
We're here for the next step forward.
Yeah. Let it happen soon. You take care. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Context of white supremacy. Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, January 7th, 2017. So I have been told. This is our first compensatory call-in for 2017. Folks would like to dial in, share their views on the audio clips that we just heard, any other events that took place over the last 7 days, or if you just have general observations, thoughts on the system of racism, white supremacy, and counter-racism, please dial in the number 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. That number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Before we get to some of the things I wanted to share, remind listeners, we are listener-supported counter-racist radio. 8-year anniversary in a matter of weeks. I hope for nearly a decade we have provided constructive information to help victims of racism, especially black people, get a more accurate understanding of what racism is, how it works. To support the broadcast, you can go to my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com, racism-notes.blogspot.com. You will see the PayPal button linked in the top right corner. If you are not into PayPal, drop me an email. We will get you a physical mailing address. Huge thanks to all the folks who have invested over the years. Really appreciate all of the support. Hope it has been worthy of your time and energy, and hopefully we will do our part to solving the problem of racism, white supremacy. That's it. A couple things that I wanted to make sure I touched on before we get started. Number one, the essay that I wrote on Dr. Francis Cress-Welsing's prediction that Donald Trump would be the successor to President Obama should be published this month. I had the folks where the piece is going to be published, so hopefully, matter of day, one way or another, it will be published by February 1. Either they will follow through and it'll be published, or I will be publishing it myself. So either way, we are counting down the days and the article will be out. Wish it had been out much sooner. I had told some of the listeners about it. Roz recommended, really encouraged me to write the piece. So excited, looking forward. Quick things that I wanted to touch on before we get to some of the callers. That 60 Minutes piece on Chicago, the violence against black people in Chicago, and the enforcement officials, them just saying they're doing their bare minimum, total propaganda piece, in my opinion, in terms of how we are supposed to think about black life and enforcement officers, racism, white supremacy. White people are amazing at playing the victim. I thought some of these white officers were going to break down in tears. Like, oh, my Lord, we have just been so difficult. I can barely get out of bed in the morning. Oh, have nightmares about Black Lives Matter. That's what I was expecting, like total propaganda piece. And I cannot, or I guess I can, and you should not be surprised, but for them to get through that entire segment that lasted about 13 minutes and not mention the name John Burge, what a disgrace. And that's beyond, I mean, that is a total act of racism, white supremacy, first and foremost. But I would say equally, that is horrendous journalism. I mean, context. Next, the segment, Dylan Storm Roof. I don't know if people have paid attention to the Dylan Roof trial. I get my general sense is that people were kind of paying attention when they were at the point of determining his guilt or innocence. And now that he's been convicted and we're at the sentencing phase, my general sense is that people are not paying attention to this. They're focused on other things, complaining about Donald Trump, cheering and celebrating the end of the Obama era. Lots of different things that people are focused on. The quote-unquote hate crime against this white male mental patient in Illinois that you heard about as well. People are focused on many other things except this trial. Many profound things have come out even just in the past 5 days. Number one, Mr. Roof was quoted as saying, "I consider myself well versed in racism." You are going to hear that quote a lot moving forward on the context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade, I am not an expert on racism, white supremacy. Mr. Dylan Storm Roof, race soldier, convicted murderer. I'm not even sure if they charged Dylan Roof with a hate crime. I have to double check. Mr. Roof said, "I consider myself well versed in racism." Not ignorant. Next, he referred to himself as Lilarian, L-I-L-Arian, in one of these online forums where racists, race soldiers, they go and post about Negroes and, you know, what they need to do to bolster the white nation. I thought that was significant. He had a film list for as frequently as movies and TV programs come up on this program and just in general when people discuss racism, white supremacy. I was astounded. They did not give the total list, but they mentioned some of the films. If people want to do any research and see if you can find the full list of films that apparently these were his favorites. Some of the ones they mentioned: 12 Years a Slave, Titanic, Pride and Prejudice, The Notebook, The Great Gatsby, the version that came out in the early 70s, and American History X. Some of these are, you know, flagrantly about racism, white supremacy. Some of these are not. I've seen quite a few of these. I have not seen The Notebook. I will try to make time to see that down the road. I will stop here. Folks would like to participate. The number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. If I may, take one more moment. Mr. Dylan Storm Roof, shame on me for not knowing if he was convicted of a hate crime. I should know that. I'll double check. I'm a victim. I'm still learning. But Mr. Dylan Storm Roof, just if you take that statement again that I said, you're going to be hearing a whole lot moving forward on the cows. Dylan Roof says, "I consider myself very well-versed in racism." Now take that statement and then what you heard in the audio clip where he said, "It's not fair that I have to sit here and listen to these niggers talk about the other niggers that I shot and killed. That's not fair." Just put those two pieces of information together as to why I say the incorrectness of using the term fair to mean justice, beauty, logic, and white. For the compensatory call-in, I do request if we could not use metaphors. We've talked about that a lot. Certainly people who have listened to the book study with Gwen Ifill, The Breakthrough, metaphors. Racists, in my view, frequently they employ metaphors to be deceptive. They're doing it deliberately and comparing items, people, things, situations that are not equivalent. They do this on a regular basis. I think a lot of victims, including myself, a lot of times, and we've had some great illustrations in the recent weeks on this very program, the compensatory call-in, where I think sometimes victims, we're all still learning, myself included, and sometimes just we have not come to a conclusion. We're still trying to just get a better understanding of our position or how we think on a particular matter, which is totally fine. I'm in that position myself, but just sometimes I think we end up using analogies or metaphors to try to help articulate our views. And frequently, same thing, we're comparing things that are not equivalent and or we really are not providing specific detail about what we mean. What are we really talking about, as opposed to just throwing out some cliche or analogy or a bit of rhetoric that is not really specific and detailed? Mr. Fuller says that on a regular basis, codification is about details. With that, thank you kindly. I will prompt about the metaphors. And also, if you know you are in a noisy environment, if you could use your mute button, super appreciated. With that, the first few people who dialed in who have a hand up, if you have commentary you would like to share, feel free.
Yes, may I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right. Greetings, guests, and to the rest of the callers. So I've also noticed that we haven't been keeping, we stopped talking about Emmett Till lately, and I haven't talked about him since 2014, the anniversary of when he died. And I'm actually grateful about the book that Linda Williams Jackson wrote, the book in the second audio, the name of it being Midnight Without a Moon. And I like that book actually a lot. Just hearing the book being explained, because they put Emmett Till's death, well, what the author has learned about his death, and puts it through a different perspective. In other words, puts it in through the eyes of a different person. And that's really powerful to me, because throughout my life, I've learned that everybody sees everything differently in their own way. And I've always remembered that. I've always noticed that throughout certain people, everybody's going to have a different opinion about something. And it's just interesting to me. And they put it in the book, and I actually like that a lot. And it's helped me it helped me move on through life knowing that. And just about, yeah, that's the book. The book seems pretty interesting, and I would like to read it. And just about another one of the audios that was played, the one about the 14-year-old white male who put on social media racial slurs about another black person in high school. And it's just, I find that pretty interesting, because just throughout, like, teenagers in my generation, like, year after year, white teenagers start to be more bold with what they say, like, how racist they are. They're just, like, more bold and direct towards people. And when you call them out, they're like, oh, I'm not racist. It's just a new trend. Everybody's saying it, so I decided why not say it. So, and it kind of is a trend, because nigga has been used since however long, 400 years ago, whenever it started. It's interesting, especially throughout high school where most gossip and drama starts. And just throughout my opinion, I think that that white person was afraid of that black person, because if he wasn't afraid, he wouldn't have said it over a screen, over social media, behind the screen. He wouldn't have said it over that. That's just common sense. See, I figure that the next day he's going to try to avoid that black person, because he has no idea what he's capable of. He could probably fight him and once he sees him. So just out of my knowledge and out of my logic of being a high school teenager, that would probably happen. And, yeah, it's just pretty – it's not weird. I really expected that to happen, and I know for a fact that that would happen. And – Because I've seen it before. It's nonsense, really. It's nonsense how social media has become to my generation. And, yeah, that's all I wanted to share. Thank you for taking my call.
Sorry, young scholar.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. I just wanted to say quickly, that was the first call. That was our young scholar in the Bay Area. Always great to hear from him. The incident that you were referencing, the racist child, where he put this Snapchat video online calling one of his black classmates a nigger, and, you know, look at the nigger eating chicken and all of that. There was a fight. This incident happened sometime, like the video and all that, this happened some time ago. So the racist child who made the video and the victim, the black student, that black child got upset and fought that white child. And apparently he, you know, put some hands on him. they suspended the black child. They didn't do anything to the white child. And so as this has continued to evolve and people say, hey, that's extra super racist to have this little white terrorist go and abuse verbally this black student, he gets upset, justifiably so, responds, and he's the one that gets punished while the racist white child, nothing happens to him. So after this went on for a while and people said that they thought that was racist, and, you know, everybody, if you're going to punish the black student, then you got to go after the white student too. Now, this is what they're doing, where the local attorney is looking to prosecute him for this video and what have you. Just add that in, that there was a fight. So your theory about this white student being afraid of this black student might have been so, because the black student did not just leave with, he did not just cower and allow this to happen. He eventually responded and put hands on this little racist child. The person that spoke up, who was going to, oh, did you want to add something else, young sir?
Oh, no, that's all. I was just, I expected the black child to get in trouble because just out of knowledge of being who I am, the black person would usually get in trouble rather than the white person. Even though he displays racial slurs over Snapchat, and the black person encountered it and defended himself towards that, I knew he would have gotten in trouble. That's just logic and common sense, just in the world that we live in right now. That's all I wanted to say.
For sure. He was charged in June. And this happened in Pennsylvania. And this happened in October. So this is like from 2-3 months ago. But anyway, this happened in Pennsylvania. And the black student, he was charged in juvenile court for retaliating against this racist child. The male caller who spoke up, we heard you already. You were going to share as well?
Yes, sir. Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and listeners. I wanted to comment on the Chicago piece, since I am in Chicago and from Chicago. I never agree with you more. Never agreed more 100% with you on that. On that 60 Minutes being a propaganda piece. Gary McCarthy, Chicago's former Supreme Race Soldier, was basically advertising for stop and frisk in Chicago. His blaming Chicago police not doing enough stops and arrests on the escalating violence is definitely the ultimate propaganda piece for bringing in stop and frisk in Chicago legally. And his vitriol of, his unconnected vitriol with Eddie Johnson, who is the current Chicago police superintendent and is a black man. It sounded like he was indirectly blaming him for the cops not doing their job. You know, typical racist to, you know, blame the black man for all the violence, even though McCarthy was the, like I said, supreme race soldier in Chicago when all the violence, you know, started and did happen. Also, too, it was interesting you said about them not mentioning John Burge. I caught that as well. But they also did not mention the name of the race soldier who killed Laquan McDonald, and that was Jason Van Dyke. So they missed his name as well, which I caught immediately. I'm like, why didn't they mention his name? So that was pretty interesting. I also mentioned last week about another thing about the journalism that they didn't do. And I read this is in the Chicago Tribune, where they said 70% of the murders have gone unsolved. So, you know, I'm wondering why they didn't mention that as well. They also mentioned a priest that known, you know, nationwide in the Chicago area, white priest, Father Flager, who is the pastor of the predominantly black Catholic church here in St. Sabina. They had a march here where they were holding crosses of all of the victims of the shootings in Chicago, majority black. I talked to a person who went to that march and who, even though mostly all of the victims were black, who were majority of the people holding up the crosses with the faces of these victims? they were white people. So I thought that was I found that pretty interesting as well. And then last
Father Flager, I just wanted to add real quick. Father Flager was the star of Spike Lee's Chirac that came out last year, unless I'm mistaken. I only know that because I was forced to sit through it one time, which was one time too many. My apologies for the interruption, sir.
Oh, God bless you on that one. But I want to also talk about the torture case that's happening here in Chicago, which is getting a lot of light here. And also comment on Whoopi Goldberg had recently commented on that. And in her confusion, you know, she mentioned that this torture case is comparable to the Dylann Roof case. And, I found that very, very problematic with that, because, first of all, Dylann Roof killed 9 people. Dylann Roof assassinated a public official and wasn't remorseful about it at all. The thing too that really got me was majority of the people who are speaking out against these black teenagers who tortured the white victim have been black people, and the white people who have commented on this have been blaming Black Lives Matter. So I thought that was, and I think one of the videos, the one of the audios you played had mentioned that as well. So, yeah, that you know, it's like white people are blaming Black Lives Matter, and black people are blaming these black teenagers who are victims as well within the system of white supremacy. Don't condone the actions at all, but, you know, I just don't understand how black people are just, like, all over these teenagers. So in Whoopi Goldberg's comment about it, you know, is, you know, just, I guess, just VGQ or confusion or, you know, whatever you want to call it. But I just thought that was pretty interesting. That's all I have in my notes right now. I'll be in my line.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, everyone. Number one, I'll start off with the Fort Lauderdale Airport incident. Fort Lauderdale Airport is the airport myself and my offspring we use when we make the choice of traveling by air. It is a very large airport. I've never seen so many in the incident that took place yesterday, never seen so many white people running for their lives in the different clips that they showed, also running with their hands up. It looked like I saw a team of white females, some sort of athletic team, and they were running in almost perfect order, running for their lives. But anyway, the main reason why I brought up the incident, because maybe it's me, but it seems as though that there was a failure to racially classify the shooter. I heard one report very early in the incident where he was quote unquote racially classified as, it is going to be confusing, white Hispanic, especially the word Hispanic. I don't even know what the heck that means, although I've heard it for the most part, the majority of my life. But when you look at him, he doesn't appear to be a white person. Number two, just want to briefly talk about the hypocrisy of the two cases involving the four non-white black people who is basically, I'm not going to use the metaphor, but they're going to be prosecuted more than likely to the full extent of the law. Whereas just recently before that, the case where the black male that was raped by a group of white males who basically are living their lives normally. I think one of them may have gotten some community hours attached to them that to him that he has to work off. Let alone talking about in this case with the black people, it was called a hate crime, and multiple other charges going to be placed on them, and I'm pretty sure that they're going to get convicted. It looked like at the hearing, according to the drawings, the judge even appeared to be a non-white black person, or at least a non-white person. It appeared to be by the drawings. They didn't have, you know, sometimes they don't have the camera, but they have drawings. That judge appeared to be a non-white person. Number three, I don't know if anybody has watched this, and I'm beginning to have a little bit of doubt about it. But anyway, a Wendy's commercial. If you care to see it now, it actually is on the NFL football games period of time. It's the commercial. It's right, but it's a Wendy's commercial. Now I saw it on a associate's Facebook yesterday for the first time, and it was a white female that was selling a new hamburger, and for some reason they wanted to make it comparable with bees that some question about their wings. Now, mind you, these bees were drawn in very, very black, as far as I'm talking about the color black, and their lips were exaggerated like the old cartoon pictures that they would have depicting non-white black people, and both of their voices sounded like straight from the series back in the 50s of Amos and Andy. Now, when I saw the commercial just a few minutes ago, they seem to have changed it to whereas instead of having two bees, it went down to one bee, and that bee sounded like more like a white person. So you can check it out. I thought I was sending you, Gus, that on your Facebook so you can see it. And everybody else can see it, but I probably messed it up and it didn't get to you. I'll try to do it again. It reminded me of a lecture that they had us on talking about African bees, and the African bees were different from the quote-unquote normal bee. It's very aggressive. They're very aggressive. They're very dangerous, much more dangerous than other bees. And this is actually a lecture they had us to sit in on when I was a firefighter. Last but not least, the Joe Mixon situation. I'm sure that you're aware of it, Gus. With Brent Musburger on the live program, he was basically kind of supporting Mr. Mixon and encouraging him. But at the same time, we got to keep our attention on white people and their history. Brent Musburger has been a sports reporter for a long time, and he is most known when it comes to racism and white supremacy for his long notation he did on Tommy Smith and John Carlos, basically identified them similar to what they did, similar to a Nazi salute. This is Brett Musburger. I'm messing up his name, but nevertheless, that's basically what I have to report on. And thank everybody for listening.
The commercial, I haven't seen it, but I did locate it, so I'm posting it on my Facebook page right now. When I was in the process of looking for the commercial, apparently other people, this must be a commercial that's only been out a week or so, but other people also think this is racist. Those were some of the first links that I saw.
Okay.
Other people
okay.
saying that they also think that this commercial is racist, the way that they have the whatever the bees look like. I'll post it so people can check it out for themselves.
You're talking about the one with the two bees?
I have no idea. Just whatever brand new Wendy's commercial with bees in it, that's the one I'm posting, and it seems other people think it's racist too, but I haven't seen it, so I don't know.
Okay, because like I said, when I saw the second one, I'm saying, wow, they really went and changed that real quick. Because the one that I saw on my associate's Facebook was actually two B's. And it was, to me, it was like obvious that they were depicting the voices of two black people. And they had thick, big red lips. Now, on the one that I just saw about maybe an hour ago, it was only one B, and it sounded like a white person. In other words, they went quickly because they got so much negative attention from it, I guess, that they went quickly and changed it and changed this commercial, tweaked it a little bit as far as that concerned. You know, I thought that was interesting. That's all.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening to everyone. I just wanted to say it appears to me that the majority of non-white black people fail to realize that, racist agencies or racist groups can orchestrate like anything that they want, and they can put it out in the news and try to direct your thinking any way that they would like it to be. And I just say that with these Chicago teenagers that, you know, supposedly, was kidnapped and assaulted this, you know, white person or white teenager or whatever. It's just like, it seems like it's out of the possibility that people think that, hey, maybe this is something that's being orchestrated. And I'm not saying that it is. Of course, I have no proof that it is or not, but I think it's always something that people should consider. And then, because I see that a lot of people are just apologizing, like, oh my God, you know, these people are horrible. They did this. And we don't really know if that actually happened. But anyway, I didn't get a chance to listen to the news clips played. I'll go back and listen to it in the archives. But I recently had the opportunity to travel outside of the United States, which I've done before. But and what I gathered from this particular trip is that just when dealing with TSA and other security agencies in different countries, is that as a non-white black person, you're not supposed to be traveling. You're supposed to stay on the plantation that you were born in and stay there and, you know, suffer from the racism there. But what I experienced really, especially from TSA here in the United States after my trip, was I'd never experienced this before, but they were questioning me about everything, like, you know, my employment, and how was I able to pay for this trip? It wasn't no, you know, extra expensive trip, but it's like, I guess got the feeling like, nigga, how are you traveling like this? And particularly, it was a white male TSA agent, or I guess customs agent, let me say that, where they went through every little piece of my luggage. Again, I've never experienced this, and I have traveled outside of the country before. And they went through everything. They looked through all. I take some herbal supplements. Sometimes they went through that. I'm assuming they thought that it was, some type of drugs. I was some contraband that I was smuggling into the U.S. And even with that, he took my supplements and took it over to a separate area where I couldn't view exactly what he was doing. And just my immediate thoughts was, this white person could be planting, he could be trying to poison me, or he can just say whatever he wants and say, oh, you got some heroin or you got some type of illegal illicit drugs that you're smuggling. So I was basically at, you know, under, you know, whatever power he had, which is, you know, white supremacy, of course. But you know, they asked me many questions like, who are you visiting? And this guy particularly, because right now I am technically I'm unemployed right now, but of course I've managed to save up some money to be able to travel, because this is something that I enjoy doing. And specifically he's like, where are you, where do you work? And I'm like, right now I'm unemployed. Maybe I should have just made up something, but I didn't. And then he said, well, how are you unemployed? I don't even travel like this, and I have a job. And I'm like, okay, well, what does that have to do with me, you know? But it just seemed like he was saying, hey, man, you supposed to stay put and, you know, let us practice white supremacy on you here, and that's it. And last but not least, I heard people speaking about this in general, about codifying themselves when talking or just relating to white people out in public. And I just noticed when you are traveling, particularly me being a relatively young black male, white people, especially white males, they want to talk to me. I think they want to know, like, hey, why are you over here? How did you get over here? You know, but they come and of course they do it under the guise of being nice and just, you know, making small talk. And at times I want to codify myself and not even talk to I want to ignore them, to be honest, but I don't do that. I usually talk and I try to ask them a lot of questions. And it just seems like these guys have been traveling to these countries for years. They have houses in these other countries and they are able to marry the women of these non-white, non-black countries, so to speak. And they're just able to do whatever they want. And I'm like, wow, that's, to me, is just another example of global white supremacy. And they get the opportunities to do stuff that I haven't got the opportunity to do. I mean, but it's just they question me a lot. And particularly there was a white male from Australia that asked me about, hey, so what do you think about, you know, your new president? And I'm like, and I just said, I'm actually looking forward to see what happens in the next 4 years or 8 years. You know, I think I said, I'm looking forward to see what happens in the next 8 years. And, you know, he kind of chuckled and we talked about something else, but, that's all I have to share right now. Thank you.
Fascinating. Just encourage listeners to not lollygag. If you have commentary you would like to share, go ahead. Get your hand up now. Do not wait till the last minute. If you have something to share, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. And again, please do not wait until the last minute. I think that was Mr. Ken Steele.
Yes. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Awesome. I just wanted to start by saying that I'm in Rancho Cucamonga, California, today, and I want to issue a warning to all listeners and all victims of racism that are living in Chicago. You're entering a very, very dangerous period. They're setting you up for, I believe, systematic annihilation. I'm not even speaking hyperbolically. When I was living in Chicago, the final year that I was living there, in the summer that I was living there, I had noticed that at night they would routinely set up roadblocks on major thoroughfares throughout the city. I know this because I would routinely just drive around looking at car crashes, really. That was one of the things that I really liked to do. But I would just see that they were setting up more and more of these roadblocks. And I don't think that that is a coincidence. I think that this latest story that they're telling right now about this supposed kidnapping and torture of a supposedly mentally disabled white person is a total fabrication designed to legitimize what is coming for the people of Chicago. President-elect Donald Trump has publicly stated to Rahm Emanuel that he intends to use federal powers to intervene in the city of Chicago. And there are a number of very concerted gentrification programs, programs that are being run as we speak, including that Whole Foods that was set up there. So if you are a resident of Southside Chicago, watch out, because this situation is about to get way worse, way fast. And the people of Chicago are being conditioned to accept what is to come. And it's not going to be in benefit to any victim of white supremacy what is about to happen there. That is precisely one of the reasons why I left. I just saw that it was getting worse and worse. And one of the final events that made me make the decision to just get out of there was that a close friend of mine was recently attacked in Chicago, and somebody put a gun in his face, and this was after he was walking home from work. So the fact that my friend, who was not involved in any sort of wayward activity, any sort of activity that would draw specific violent attention to himself, other than just being black and outside at night in Chicago, it led to him having a near-death experience. That was a signal enough to me that it was time to leave. But for those of you who cannot leave, just prepare and be aware that you are being set up for some tremendous violence on the horizon. I don't know if that's a metaphor, but there's tremendous violence that's about to come to the people, to the victims of racism that are living in Chicago. Also, related to that, they are using this incident, and they're using showcased victims of racism to fuel the energy that is behind seeing this as a grave offense. I believe that Whoopi Goldberg was recently compared this situation to the attack that was staged by Dylann Roof on the AME church. The fact that that was even put on broadcast TV should be a signal to you that there is some tremendous violence that is about to occur behind this. They used President Barack Obama and his so-called bully pulpit. He was using that to fuel the flames, or rather to fuel the energy that's behind railroading these children, these young people that are being charged with all of these crimes. Please, victims of racism, do not succumb to all of this energy that is being placed behind this. I believe they also used Montel Williams to say that these people deserve the death penalty and that these people should be locked up for life, and just very hyperbolic speech coming out of what appears to be selected, showcased victims of racism. Please do not succumb to this. And also,
hang tight, real quick. Going forward, make sure we get everybody in so they get their one chance. And then once we have our extra time, you can feel free to follow up with whatever else you have left, Mr. Steele. We have other people that we have not heard from at all. Any folks that have not been able to speak at all, you should go now.
Can I be heard?
Heard both of you.
Can I be heard?
I will get Roz first, and then we'll get our other caller.
All right. Greetings to you, Gus, and to the other callers and listeners. Yeah, I agree with Ken Steele. I think that they're setting up something potentially major. Thomas in New York has talked about for quite a while that they want to clear the black people out of Chicago, kind of like what they're facilitating in Detroit right now. So I do agree with him on that. A couple of things. weirdly enough, last night I was coming home from work, and just as we were about to get off the highway, just speaking to what Gus always talks about, sobriety would be best. Black male, walking pedestrian, drunk, just drunk, and stopped by the police. It was just the most incredible scene to bear witness to, because it's been a long time since I've seen a black male stopped while walking and be intoxicated like I did yesterday. So I just wanted to throw that out there. I love the clip that you played about the black inventors. I thought that was just really insightful. I appreciate that. Hopefully we can hear more content like that. It kind of reminds me of Dr. Ivan Van Sertima's book, Blacks in Science, Ancient and Modern. It's a good book for people to check out if they're into that sort of stuff, studying the history of our black inventors. Also, the clip that you played with the black female who discussed, well, she wrote the book of following the Emmett Till story. I found that to be pretty fascinating, and something that we should deal with, black people should deal with, in regards to being more understanding of other victims of racism when they are fearful. This system is designed to terrorize and make us scared. Just studying the history of seasoning plantations should give enough insight into that, so that we're not judgmental of other victims of racism who behave and react in a most fearful manner and may not react the way that we might feel is appropriate in the situation, simply because we might not be fearful in the same way that that person is, potentially under the same circumstances, or we might assume that we wouldn't be. I'll put it that way. So I just thought that clip was very important. The clip that you played about the black female that she was discussing, the black people patronizing restaurants that practice racism, I found that to be very interesting as well. It kind of reminds me of Fanta soda. A lot of people don't know that Fanta was actually, it's a Coca-Cola company, but it was actually a Nazi drink. And specifically, Nazis were drinking it during the World War II, World War I era. It was considered the Nazi drink. And any money that was generated by it was funneled directly into racism, white supremacy via the Nazi activities in Germany. So it's just something for us to think about. I thought that was really great, the assessment that she gave about us not supporting businesses that practice racism and looking for businesses that don't practice racism and put money back into the community in regards to us trying to patronize businesses of those types. Also, the clip you played about the rape of children in the Central African Republic by the French government is just disgusting, and it just proves to me that the UN is completely impotent in every way, shape, or form. To me, it is the global political wing of racism, white supremacy. The role that the UN has always played is in protecting global sexual deviance committed by white people from all different countries, and just protecting white supremacy and allowing these more powerful races the ability to just do whatever they want on a global scale. And the non-white countries are having to just sit and suffer whatever the consequences are of what these disagreeable beings do. The clip about the Chicago violence in Chicago, there was a black male ex-police officer who said in the clip that the Chicago PD is not racist, yet there are racists in the department. And I find that to be an oxymoron when you understand the origin of the police department in slave catching and protecting racism, white supremacy, and facilitating the practice of brutalization against black people specifically. So to me, every police department is a racist organization made by racists in order to subjugate non-white people, and more specifically and intensely black people. So I found that to be a very confusing phrase, I think, that would be confusing to other non-white victims of racism, white supremacy. And the final thing I wanted to touch on was your clip on Dylann Roof. One thing I do like about him is that he's extremely blatant about how he feels about racism, white supremacy, and his hatred for black people. He is not statements of remorse. I'm really glad that that's the way that he's approaching this, because I think it should help to bring home the idea that this is the way white people function all the time, and that when you see white people displaying the remorse in any form or fashion, it's usually remorse because they're caught, not remorse because they're sorry for what they did to black people. And also, when you were discussing him using the term that it was not fair for him to have to hear niggas complaining about him murdering their relatives, I thought about it the same way. I thought he was saying it's not white for me to have to hear them, because white people don't care. They don't want to hear what you have to say. You know, I murdered you, so what? Deal with it. On to the next. And as soon as you said it, it made me think that he was saying it's not white for me. It's not fair. It's not white for me to have to sit here and listen to this nonsense. White people kill black people for fun. That's the way it was. That's the way it should always be in perpetuity. And I hope that he continues to a lawyer for himself and puts himself right into the death penalty, and hopefully they do give it to him. I don't care what the victims of racism want in regards to that. I think he deserves to be off as quickly as possible, and I hope it does happen. I think they might find a way not to do so, but I hope that that does happen. Thank you very much. Oh, and the last thing, Gus, I'm just excited. Keep us posted on the publishing of the piece that you wrote. I'm super excited to hear, to read it, because I love your writing. If they don't do so and you have to publish it yourself, just please let us know. I'm just excited to see what you had to write about that. And I know that you did a great honor to Dr. Wellstein. Thank you so much. And I'll mute my line.
Appreciate that, Roz. Yes, sir. Feel free, sir.
Hey, greetings to the guest and greetings to the host. I would first like to piggyback off the Chicago violence. I'd like to remind everyone that 70%, I was told 70% of the Chicago shootings are not solved. So, you know, the whole notion of the black-on-black crime and all that type of stuff, you know, just keep that in mind. Draw your own conclusions, whatever that may be. I got my own. Next door, I'm going to be real quick. But next door is a white kid that lives next door. I got two daughters. They all play regularly. There's another black kid, two houses down. They all play together. I found this little white kid. He had to be about 7 or 8, and he was just tugging and pulling on this black kid, tugging and calling him a thug. And I said, hey, you know, what you doing? Quit. Cut it out. He looked at me with his blue eyes and said, we're playing cops and robbers. So, you know, I had to cut that out right off the bat. I doubt that the black kid regularly plays the cops. So I already knew what it was, and that just proves your point, Gus, that at a very young age, white people are not white kids. A man, woman, a child is not ignorant about racism. I often watch the cartoons that my little girls, I got 3-year-old and a 1-year-old, I watch the cartoons that they watch, and I had picked up on one, which all the time, I point out racism all the time, and it was this one episode, though, I forgot the name of the show, and it was about, like, fishes in the sea, like whales and sharks, and for some reason, you know, it was about the shark having a bad rap, and it was like a big metaphor, you know, the shark, and he went on a long tangent song about how sharks always get stereotyped, and, you know, this is for children, so, you know, it was more subtle than that, but it was talking about I just want to tell my tale, the shark tale, and I immediately had connected that with racism. Third thing, Gus, have you guys ever talked about Pepe the Frog, the little green frog that be all over the internet and stuff? You guys have run that up yet?
That's not something that I haven't touched on. I think some other folks have brought that up, and them saying that it's racist, and that kind of became a bigger deal kind of towards the end of 2016. But that's not something that I've talked about on the program.
Yeah, I think it's very important, you know, that we pay attention to that, because white people, they are very good at replacing the white face with a green face, and now he's like a symbol of the alt-right, quote-unquote alt-right, that they got going on. And I think people need to pay close attention to that, because they do a good job at stuff like that, replacing, you know, and now, you know, that they're represented by a green frog. So it's just taking the whole white out of it. And, you know, I just picked that up right away, you know. One more thing. The environmental racism. Were you ever going to touch on that in any future programs? Environmental racism.
Absolutely. I have.
I heard you have
a Chicago book, no less. I have one specifically on Chicago, this problem there, and then another one that addresses it more broadly. But black people specifically have this is a big problem for black people. In fact, I saw a report this week where it was I believe the Koch brothers, they were talking about fossil fuels and saying that we need to get black people involved in this because fossil fuels is going to be the next wave of environmental racism. So we got to get black people on board with this. I was stunned because I'd never heard anything associated with the Koch brothers. We're like, yeah, we got to get these black people riled up and get them, you know, motivated and paying attention to this. This is the next wave of racism. So yes, we should have multiple. We should have done at least one of these last year, but we failed. 2017. That'll be on our assignment list.
Okay, good, good. Yeah, because I was waiting on that. I heard you had mentioned that, you know, a while back. Last thing I want to see before I get on the line, Gus, I'm very grateful because as soon as I started listening to your program, you talking about sobriety is best in time of war. I have been 8 months clean, no alcohol, no marijuana. So I thank you. My family, thank you. I'm completely clean, and I guess that's it.
All right. Beautiful. Best news of the day. That is spectacular. Awesome illustration of black self-respect right there. I know Dr. Welzing, huge commendation for that. That is outstanding. Best news I've heard for the day. That just that right there. We just had more black people who were serious about that. I mean, the amount of problems, the amount of money that we could save just in so many different ways. Just doing great job, just taking care of yourself so you can be there for those young girls that you have. That is phenomenal, sir. Music to my ears. Oops, sorry, metaphor. But that is phenomenal. Always love hearing that.
Yeah, I had more to share, but I guess I'll say that for workplace racism. Also, I forgot one thing about the little white kid next door. Also, on a separate occasion, the trampoline in their backyard, and I could see it over my fence. I also seen, you know, how kids experiment. He was experimenting sexually with a little black kid on the trampoline, like they was like playing with each other. And, you know, me and my wife was laughing at it, but I later on thought about it, like that's some racism right there. Like already, you know, in the front yard, he tugging and pulling on them, playing cops and robbers and calling them a little thug and stuff. And in the backyard, you know, looking at his genitalia. And I mean, yeah, it just all makes sense, man. I truly appreciate the show. You helped me a lot, and I guess
that's
all I had to say.
For sure. Appreciate that, sir. Other folks, if we have not heard from you at all, you should speak up now. Just to the last comment that he made, that was together in the 60 Minutes report on Chicago, that abusing police, abuse of black people, and then he said the black officer who said that he quote-unquote snitched and tried to speak up and say that incorrect things were happening, he said that he watched a black male literally strip searched right out in public, which is the exact same thing Eric Garner said about New York's Finest before he was choked to death. Daniel Pantaleo. Anyone we have not heard from at all?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much. Good evening, Thomas from New York. I have a few things to say about the clips, but absolutely, man. Well, very constant strip searching was very big in both New Jersey and New York by the police. Yeah, Chicago is going through a phase of gentrification. This is going to be forced gentrification, unlike New York. So this is going to be implemented, I believe, when the president is no longer the president and he goes back to Chicago. That's going to be their one of the key things they're going to use to start removing black people. Because when I went to Chicago, what was shocking was how close the quote-unquote hood was to the downtown business district. Something that's really, you know, that doesn't happen in New York. You know, like they really uptown. Or we across the river, We're not like in that area. We can't afford it, you know. So even Capri Green, I don't think was too far from like down in that area. I was like, wow. So that I could see being a huge case for the gentrification. As far as the cliffs go, the piece about the inventors, very interesting. I think that when the journalist did a little chuckle around the time when she was talking about he wanted to ask her questions about the black women inventors, the people who invented things as her hair. And it was like, yeah, these black y'all really are into your hair, huh? And she kind of diverted away from that, but I just felt like that was an act of racism on his behalf. Of course, you know, the hair thing is a big deal amongst black people. And I would like to say when I was a kid, Super Soaker, I'm glad to hear that was invented by a black man. That was a game changer as far as water guns. Because prior to that, you had a little water pistol, you put water in it, and you squeeze the trigger, and it got a little spritz that came out. And when the Super Soaker came out, you could pump it. I mean, it caused a lot of fights, but it was a great, you know, thing. So I'm glad to hear a black guy did that. Fisk University, all I kept thinking about while hearing that piece is Union General Clinton B. Fisk, a white man. That's who the school is named after. So, you know, that's all I can think about. They cut the cop's picture out and put it on the urinal and paid on it at his retirement party. I mean, dedicated. I like that piece. I thought that was pretty telling. better fall back in line. That's what happens when black cops fall out of line. At his retirement party, or nonetheless, like, I mean, they waited for this man to have his retirement party to get, you know, they never forget. The black teens who tortured the white mentally challenged white kid, they're not going to get any mercy by the courts, unfortunately. It's going to be pretty much a wrap for them. Whatever the maximum is, they're going to get it. And unfortunately, the only problem I really have with the whole tape is that they videotaped it. I mean, you got to be more codified. You know, everything is not meant to go on World Star or Facebook or whatever. I mean, it has to be... If you're going to do something, I mean, any crime, black people, do not put your camera out and take a picture or have your friend picture in it. It's just not a smart idea. Dylan Roof, man, I have no problem with the death penalty, but it just seems like, see, I'm an advocate for torture, and I just feel like he's a prime candidate. You know, you kill 9 people, you only could die once, you know. But I appreciate his him sticking to his code, and I mean, he's a dedicated, full-fledged white supremacist. He's sticking to his code to the end, and he didn't want to hear about. He don't care about how them niggas feel. I have no mercy. You know, he's pretty much telling the judge, listen, I ain't crazy. I know exactly what I did. Right? I went in there, killed some niggas. They deserved it. We had a race war. You don't see it. I don't know what's wrong with you, but I know what's going on, and I'm the first one to go. And that's his mentality, and I'm glad that he's sticking with it. I'm still not convinced that he's going to get the death penalty, but anything can happen. If I have time, I just wanted to say right now, I always hear black people talk about boycotting, and I just think this is, just looking at the news, perfect time to boycott. You look at all these white businesses, these corporations who make so much money off of black people, number one consumers, and they don't put more money back into our neighborhoods. So they're going out of business now. It looks like losing a lot of stores. Macy's, Sears, Kmart, Kohl's, a lot of brands, Aeropostale, another one, a lot of them are going out of business now. And I think this is the perfect time for us to boycott them. I mean, this would be like the dagger I mean, they can't survive without the black box. So that's all I wanted to say, and thank you for my time. And I also look forward to reading your piece.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you. I was just trying to get in real quick. Go ahead.
I'm straight. I just wanted to get in my gratitude. I'm all good.
Okay. Greetings, folks. For the piece about the adventures and the inventions, it had me reconsider just how much of an economical loss we've been just taking over and over and over again. Gus has mentioned it a few other times, but it just reminded me again, so many, you know, in the piece, it was expressed that we could invent things, but we could make no money from it. And even the interviewer was like, oh, well, naturally. And I mean, it's just disgusting how much they have taken from us. Like, just, and I don't even have the words to eloquently articulate just how much was taken from us and made us be where we are today so that they could be where they are today and how okay they are with it. But that's one of the things I thought about for that. Regarding the story with Emmett Till, my first question was, I'm assuming it's a white woman. I could be totally incorrect. But did she even read the book? Based off of her questions, they were so superficial, so like level surface. I did not feel like she read the book at all. And then I don't think that black people demanded for, like, the quote was, black people weren't demanding for change. And I don't think that that's, they were afraid of change and that they wanted things to stay the same. I think that after viewing so many black people who had attempted to change or make change, the terroristic white backlash pretty much terrified them and traumatized them. And so they really just wanted to keep away the negativity of trying to better anything. And if they could exist in a certain way, that they kind of would. She mentioned one of the family members being loved by whites. And I think she knew the answer to her question. She was like, well, is it because they liked him or loved him as a real person or because he just was a complacent person? I think she knows the answer. I do not appreciate, nor, and I just like to point it out anytime because it changes the way the narrative is said, is when we call it a great migration, it's not a great migration. It's a fleeing of black people from terrorism. And so I think it needs to be spoken like that, in the same way that we view people from various African countries on the continent fleeing Africa for whatever reason over to other countries. We didn't really have another country to go to, so we fled the South to the North, and we should be viewed as refugees and victims of racism, white supremacy, and not just folks who had a bad lot in the South and were looking for better jobs, as the narrative is always expressed. Ethnic harassment, I just wanted to mention that that was something one of the clips said. There we go with the invention of new terms instead of just calling it racism, white supremacy, or white terrorism. The child who was slammed by the police in school, it would be wonderful. Like, this is how I know we're not, and when I say we, I just mean everybody. Like, you know, not necessarily considering what racism and white supremacy is doing to our mental health. No, like, she couldn't even really talk about it without getting ready to cry. And, like, she didn't even know what to do because she was in shock. So I doubt that she's receiving any type of, like, mental health is even being addressed there, but that's enough to cause PTSD. Like, next time someone touches her, she could be jumping. Like, everything could be different from her. It's not as simple as, oh, it happened and it's over. And it's unfortunate so many of us just walk around, myself included, constantly in a state of fear. In the clip about Bagatelle, I would like to know if anyone knows what DO stands for. I understand do DNA, but I didn't understand what DO was. And for the clip on the sexual abuse, one thing that's like, it bothers me so much, I was looking online, I could not find a single person's name. The only name I found led me to a highly melanated Black African male. I cannot find any names of anybody else. In the state, this is, it doesn't matter. In the states, anything you do will be put on the internet with your name. You could get stopped for a ticket and it's on the internet with your name. Why can we not find any of the names of these people who went over to CAR and sexually abused children? It's atrocious. I mean, I'm not the best researcher, but I can kind of be kind of quick with it. And it really shouldn't be that I have to scour the internet for that kind of information. Names and pictures, if not convictions. I think I might have hit my five. I have. I'm trying to be laconic and concise here. So if there's time later, I'll come back. Thank you.
Any folks that we have not heard from at all? Anyone that we have missed, if you have a hand up and you had commentary to share, please do not wait till the end of the broadcast. Go ahead and share your thoughts now.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening to Gus. Good evening to all of the listeners. This is V from Central New York. Man, Gus, this show always recalibrates my thinking on the week, just when I think I have an appropriate or an approximate understanding of the world and what's happening. I listen to this program and my mind turns again. So very quickly, if I can just contribute one thought about Chicago and the gangs. Of the various books that I've been looking through over the past couple of years, I have been stunned to find at least one dozen studies from the 60s and the 70s, along with maybe two or three books that deals exclusively with Black gang cultural structure, development, cultivation, and expansion in various cities, but it seems the most notorious city which was studied was Chicago. I do not believe that is coincidence. Secondly, as far as Chicago is concerned, I do not believe it's coincidence that for the past several years, we have been treated to a program called Chicago Blue, if I'm getting that program's name correct, which heroizes, or that might be the wrong word, but it deifies the Chicago police officer. There you go. And Fox News, which I do not frequently watch, but it's on when I'm at work, has been preparing the ground. Oh, that is a metaphor. They have been speaking robustly of the idea that a President Trump may indeed federalize the Chicago Police Department or possibly send the military into Chicago to, at first, they spoke of remove the immigrants, which there is an interesting paper on the Black man being seen as an internal immigrant within the United States, which I found several months ago. And secondly, to deal with the violence, which is prevalent in Chicago. They have been talking about this now for 3 months, even before Mr. Trump was selected. Finally, on my end, I read in the Wall Street Journal, this is sort of old, from November 30th, on page 2 of the first section, headline, White Deaths Exceed Births. Very interesting article if you can find it at your local library. And same section, page 87, U.S.-China will remain intertwined. The column is about the history of the Chinese in the United States. However, the picture that is shown are of undeniably non-white, black-skinned people from China in the United States. I thought this was very interesting and very telling. And then to conclude, I have had several racist encounters over the past month. I've been called nigger 3 times in public, once at a local establishment, and twice out on the streets. I have had 2 supposedly mentally challenged white persons who have shown open hostility towards me over the past month, and a self-described, another one, mixed friend from a Caribbean country has confided in me that he may be returning shortly because of the racism in this country, whereas his skin is valued in this Caribbean country because he is half white, half black. Up where we are at, he's just another nigga. Thank you very much, Gus. I am enthusiastically awaiting that piece that you are to have published shortly. Have a good evening, everybody.
Thank you. I posted that Wall Street Journal report from the end of November. I posted that on my Facebook page just now. Other folks that we have not heard from at all, if you have not spoken, you have commentary to share, you had your hand up, please don't wait till the last minute. Go ahead, speak now.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. I did hear that term ghetto was used in the audio segment. And like, I don't want to get into the area of saying this metaphor, but in terms of a definition, I think Mr. Fuller also mentioned about it being like a mentality as far as defining ghetto, and also in the segment where they, I guess one of the code words for a section, I guess an unfavorable, poor quality section of the establishment where I guess black people were led to go and frequent was called the ghetto portion of the restaurant. I thought that was very interesting. And I wanted to also mention, I seen it was an interview with the Richard Spencer guy. I guess, linked to the alt-right. And I noticed that people, they still continue to call him a white nationalist. But I seen him on these interviews, you know, expectedly, he's going to deny that title or that label. And I bring him up to say that it was a question, two questions that was asked of him. The first one was, are you a white supremacist? And he said, oh, no, of course not. You know, white supremacy, that was something of the past where, you know, we're not really dominating and conquering people anymore. So that's the thing of the past. Basically, he said something like that. Then the female, she asked a follow-up question. Well, do you believe that the United States, in the United States, white culture should be supreme? So she used both of them terms in a different way, and he seemed to answer the question more of a yes way. So he says, well, you know, my ancestors, they helped discover this country, and basically just doing a lot of bragging. And he ended up saying yes at the end of that second question. Then I think that term double speak has been used. He, at the end of that interview, he says, well, you know, who needs a country where it's about this multiculturalism? You know, we need somewhere where we've had conquerors, where we had people that was dominant. But see, he just, at the beginning of the interview, he said, I'm not a white supremacist. We don't dominate people anymore. So I thought that was very slick of him. I can't remember which interview it was. I think it was a CNN interview. Another thing I wanted to touch on was the black female. I guess she was going to a car, and I think something was written on there with mustard or something, and a naked woman was drawn on the car. And it was interesting that they was using a bunch of food products. Like, I don't know if it could be a potential Wilson moment in that as well. But that was interesting as well. And I think the guy's name is Mumia, when he was talking about the hepatitis, and they were conducting, I think he said, unconstitutional medical practices, where they found a cure to what people had ailments for. And like the one guy, he said, they gave him a pill and he died the next day. I mean, it just goes to show you that the amount of power that white supremacists unfortunately have over the world's non-white people is just very critical. And that's something I had no idea of, and it should be something everybody in a system of justice should have general basic knowledge of, about their bodies and the things that could be of a potential harm to them. But the racists withhold, as Mr. Fuller said, constructive information. And speaking of people stealing things, I think there's been a report of David Duke distorting Mr. Fuller's quote. Have you heard about that, Gus?
How's it distorted?
Like, it was something about if you don't understand Jewish supremacy, what it is and how it works, everything else you understand will only confuse you.
I first started hearing that, I'm going to say 2010, I might be off by a year or so, but it was within the 5 years ago range. One of our previous guests on the program, Kush the Black Unifier, he's been a guest on multiple times. I think I heard he and even some other victims of racism use that phrase. I've heard it before, and I've heard Mr. Fuller, at least the codification that I've heard from him or his response, where I've heard him talk both publicly on people's radio programs and just in phone conversations that I've had with him, where he said he's heard that, where people, you know, have started doing the same thing, taking his phrase and changing it. Add a word here, add a word there, put the Jewish thing or what have you. And he said that's fine as long as it does not get attributed to him, so that people are not going out and saying that, oh, yeah, Mr. Fuller said, if you don't understand Jewish supremacy, what it is and how it works, then that should not be happening at all. If you want to take something he wrote and change it and call it yours, fine. But just make sure that you, as he says, stand by your work so people know you are the one. Let's say John is the one that's saying that if you don't understand Jewish supremacy, everything else will confuse you. And then Mr. Fuller says, if you don't understand racism, everything else will confuse you. That's what I've heard him, his response to all that.
Yes, sir. That makes perfect sense. Thanks for the clarity, and I'll pretty much end right there. Thank you.
For sure. Other folks that we have missed, anybody that has not been able to share at all, we have about 15 minutes or so remaining. You should don't wait till the last minute. Go ahead and share now. Oh, did we get everybody? Nobody got missed. Nobody has a hand up that has been omitted, left out. Don't want to get any raging emails, people saying that they had a hand up and that they were ignored, that I didn't get their mute button. So we got everybody. Awesome. I did check. Dylan Stormroof was convicted of a hate crime, for whatever it's worth. I mentioned that at the beginning of the program. And if people are looking, if anyone has spare time and energy, I did mention the films. I've not seen the full list, so if anyone is able to locate the list in its entirety in terms of these films that Mr. Roof mentioned. I would like to see it. Not that I want to sit and watch all of these films and take notes, although that may be of some constructive value. I would just be curious to see what all films, what were all of the films that he listed? They felt it was, you know, noteworthy enough to bring it up at all that he had this list and to even go through and mention some of the films that were on it. Let's get the whole list since that's what this whole process is supposed to be about, discovery. Let's get all the evidence so that we can understand this tragedy. If anyone can find the whole list, please share. Folks have I didn't get to play. It was a lot of stuff that happened this week. There were a lot of segments that I did not get to play. Bobby Bowden, he's a retired football coach at Florida State University, where he came out and said that he was talking, reminiscing about his days coaching Negros down in Tallahassee. And he said that all of the black male football players that he has down in retired fire, I'm sure he knows all about Bobby Bowden. He said, yeah, we used to go and recruit all these black males. And of course, they don't have daddies, you know, Negros. So they all just imitate their mom. Mom is the mom and she's the dad. So they all want to be like the man, which is their mom. And so that's why they all got earrings and are trying to be like their mom. This was on an ESPN program this week where he did all of this. And then afterwards, I'm like, wow, that sounds kind of racist. And I even if you want to go the other route, because I have heard Mr. Fuller talk about the emasculation of black males, if that is happening, why is that happening? Isn't that part of the plan of racism, white supremacy, long running, connecting that all the way back with lynching? See, when whites, when they come out and they'll give you a little bit, they'll pick out some of the things that do happen in the system of white supremacy, but they make sure to take no blame so that it's always something defective about Negroes. See how retarded and ignorant and stupid you all are? You can't even raise your children correctly to be men. They're just going around copying. What would they do if they didn't have good old Bobby Bowden to take care of them down here in Florida? We do what we can down here on the Tallahassee plantation. That was one. I think there was another one. Basketball GM for the Atlanta Hawks was saying that he knows how to deal with conflict because he's married to a black female and there's always rowdiness at his house. You can insert the cowbell. Lots of stuff went down first week of 2017. Other folks have things that they want to make sure they got in. Even if you already shared anything quick you want to get in before we conclude the broadcast.
Can I bear it?
Yes, sir.
One of the movies that was referenced to Dylan Roof was The Great Gatsby. And from my understanding, Lopper Stoddard's book, The Rising Tide of Color, was referenced in that movie. So that was pretty interesting. And one more thing, I forgot to add to which the Chicago police, they have sensitivity training. And what they do is they take the police to a Holocaust museum in Skokie, which is on the northern suburb, but they don't take them to the DeSabo Museum, which is an African-American museum. So that's pretty interesting, where majority of the people that they lock up are non-white black people. So just wanted to add that.
Dr. Welzing's sister, Lauren Kress-Love, she mentioned the DeSabo Museum in Chicago and the significance of that establishment. Check it out if you are in the area. Other folks that are on the line? Yes, sir.
Oh, sorry for interjecting, guys. Yes, I just wanted to touch on a very funny workplace incident that took place on Friday. As I was leaving work, I was talking to a couple of the security guards. They were black and non-white. And we've talked before about all kinds of things, racism, white supremacy, all kinds of stuff. So we're sitting there having a conversation. And one of the security guards sent me a free copy of Birth of a Nation because I don't go to the movies. That's one of my part of my code. I'm not spending money on white supremacists entertainment. So anyway, we were talking about that, and he was going to put the video on a disc for me, but I didn't have any space on any of the discs. So he ended up sending it to me in Google Drive. So we were having a discussion about the movie because I said I really did want to see it. I just wasn't going to the movies to see it. So as the discussion came up, we ended up discussing the documentary that I talked about before on Nat Turner and whatnot. We were getting into a discussion about that. And then one of the security guards said, you know, a lot of black people don't know what happened to Nat Turner. And I said, well, if you want to really get detail, I told him about the Delectable Negro. And I went into discussing some of the details of what happened to him, and the one of the actual security guard I was talking to, the other ones was just listening to our discussion. He chimed in as well, and we discussed the fact that the slaves refused to take castor oil for like 2 years after the incident, because castor oil was one of the things that they did with his body, was use it as castor oil and force the slaves to eat, you know, to partake of it as a form of our cannibalism forced upon the slaves. So they would not use it in the Virginia area for about 2 years after the incident, if I remember correctly from the book. So come to find out, as we're having this discussion, this white guy is there, and I didn't see him at first. He wasn't there at first. So we're talking, and I said, well, yeah, I said, they skinned him, they boiled his skin, they made all kinds of, wallets out of him and stuff. And I said, I talked about the white guy who brought his skull to the museum, saying that they were the African American Museum in D.C., History Museum, and said that his family passed it down as a family heirloom and he wanted to return it to the family. So I went into that whole discussion. And I said, yeah, so that's what they do. You know, they'll cut your testes off, cut your penis off, put it in a formaldehyde jar and pass it down. So one of the other security guards starts laughing and he starts pointing at the white guy. So when everybody turns and look, and it's like 1, 2, 3, about 4 or 5, including me, and then the white guy. And everybody turns to look at the white guy, and he is as red as a beet, just severely embarrassed. And everybody just fell out laughing because it was like he was exposed. It was like he didn't know what to do. And I'm sitting there looking at him, and I said, it's historical fact is what it is, you know. And they just like, I mean, they had the laugh of a century, and he started laughing too. But it was more or less, in my opinion, his laughter was more to dissipate the embarrassment for this information about what was done to black people, specifically Nat Turner, being exposed and him happening to walk upon this conversation. Never saw the guy before, don't really care, but it was just interesting to see his reaction in that moment. And just the look on his face was priceless. That's all I have to say, but it was something I wanted to discuss. Thank you, and I'll meet my line.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, wait, guess if you were you about to respond? I'm sorry, I'll wait.
I was just going to let folks know time is winding down, that you should speak up now if you have commentary.
The last thing I wanted to comment on, I believe it was Mr. Steele. I do think that Chicago is about to enter a very difficult time. But I also think that's true for all of us. They may be used as maybe like an experimentation place, but I think that all of it is about to get bad for non-white people, specifically black people. And I've been trying to do my due diligence by making sure that I keep the conversation with the people that I care about most very focused on racism, white supremacy, and making sure that, you know, in between moments of their television watching, I abhor television. I don't have the attention span for it. But I make sure to, you know, say, hey, you know, as a family, these are things we need to consider, that we need to talk about, that we need to make sure that we keep our eyes on. I'm female. And some of the things that I've just been doing, like, I wasn't kidding. I did get my tactical pen. They have tactical pen videos. I do believe in the becoming familiar with a firearm, even if you don't own one. I think going ahead and tackling that fear that I feel like some people have. I don't have it. I'm out in Virginia, but some people might. So, you know, going and, you know, touching a real one, seeing what it's like. You never, I mean, in many, you know, life isn't like a movie, but it's quite possible someone could approach you with it. It might drop. You have no, you know, you would just want to be familiar. These things are sold at Walmart, even, you know, BB guns. And some time that I've spent on YouTube, I mean, white children are very comfortable with firearms, very comfortable, like scary comfortable. And I just think that, I mean, even like using a knife, like having mace on you, just being very prepared, because when I'm paying, reading through history and things like that, sometimes whites are not giving the non-whites any warning. It just happens. And you could be on a trolley and a bus and get snatched up and shot on the road just because a rumor got spread or something got started. So I don't take that lightly at all. And I think that, yes, what is happening in Chicago with the passive resistance, the police are pretty much saying, if we can't kill without impunity, we don't really want to be police, so we'll just do the bare minimum. But even with the other things that are going on, I don't think that that is far from possible for areas that are concentrated with Black people. And so I just wanted to say on the call to, and perhaps other females who are listening but haven't heard from, or, who might listen to the archive, to go ahead and prepare it for it. There was like a quote that I read somewhere, and I'm going to totally mess up the quote, but it's like, at first they came for such and such, I didn't say nothing. Then they went for such and such, I didn't say nothing. They went for such and such, I didn't say nothing. Then they came for me, and there was no one to stand for me. So we could be like, oh yeah, Chicago, New York, Atlanta, or something like that. But it could very well be Virginia, California, all these other places that people may not think. So being very serious about making sure that we keep logical, action-based responses, at least to give ourselves a fair shot at fighting, and just being, when you're prepared, you just feel better, more secure in yourself. I just wanted to say that. Thank you.
There's that word fair again. Did anybody have a final comment they wanted to get in before we get ready to wrap things up?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I just wanted to say that if anybody has noticed, these race soldiers are operating throughout the internet and have been doing so for quite some time. And I'm learning more and more as I find out about people who have the skills to manage big data, about how embedded these people are in the systems that we are using every day to communicate. And I think that there ought to be a mind amongst victims of racism to form compensatory apparatuses under which that we can communicate, network in much the same manner as they do. I think that there needs to be a concerted effort to make a so-called black Reddit, for instance, just a place where we can network that's heavily moderated so that the influence of suspected racists are minimized, because they will be there, but are minimized. And I think that there should be a concerted effort to create apparatuses with which we can network and stage counter offenses that are taking place on the internet. And that's just my final thought. I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Gus, can I speak to that previous caller briefly?
You got 40 seconds.
Okay. There is a community started by Scotty Reed called the BTR community. It's a closed community. It's $24 per year, $2 per month, where Black people get together and discuss all kinds of issues as it pertains to Black people. And it's a closed environment, no data mining. There's no trolls, no alphabet boys on there. So it's something I wanted to throw out there. It's btrcommunity.com. And lastly, rest in peace to Tillicum, the orca who practiced counter-racist violence and killed one of his white trainers. Thank you, and I'll mute my line.
Yes, rest in peace to Tillicum. And can you get that link to Gus so that, because it's hard to hear over the phone.
Sure, that's no problem. I'll email it to him.
What's the link again?
It's on BTR community. It's it's like a Facebook for Black people, and all we discuss on there all the time is things pertaining to racism, white supremacy, or anything as it pertains to Black people that is positive. And I've been on it practically since it started. And right now we have about, I think, 125 people on there. Scotty's on there all the time. Quite a bit of the radio hosts from Black Talk Radio are on there, and a whole bunch of callers and listeners and other people. And we communicate about all kinds of things, post events that are in local areas across the country where Black people live, and all kinds of stuff. So it's a really, really positive environment, and no white people. And it's closed, so there is no data mining. No one's tracking your clicks. No one's sending your information, selling your information to anyone else. It's just us being able to talk amongst ourselves in a closed community. And you just pay that.
I'm gonna hop in right there. We got the address. Folks could go check it out, and we did our three. No apologies needed. All good, or it's not all good, but at least that is grand. Thank you for the information, Goshier. Mr. Reed and everyone at the Black Talk Radio Network would appreciate the support. We will be here later in the week. I'm actually trying to see if we can get Pam back on, because we were supposed to do a program last month and she had tough stuff going on. So we're going to reschedule, see if we can make it happen coming up for January. If you get confused, have issues, drop us an email, untiljustice@gmail.com, untiljustice@gmail.com. I hope the broadcast was a constructive investment of your Saturday evening. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in, sharing. Stay codified. I know it's the weekend. Heard it directly from the caller this evening. Black Father, sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. Let's make sure we're in the correct mind state. If we should have to deal with a Daniel Holtzclaw, Darren Wilson, any other race soldier, badge or no, they are super, super dangerous, and I don't think us being intoxicated is going to help us neutralize the threat of racist man, racist woman, racist child. With that, thanks everyone for tuning in. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places. Each and every time we are in contact with another Black person, it has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.